Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio by Jerry Lange to tell us about her current exhibit at the San Francisco Public Library in the African American Center. It opened February 2nd and continues through May 3rd. And Ms. Lange is actually going to be giving a special talk this Sunday, February 24th, from 2 to 4, at that same library, only downstairs in the Corrett Auditorium. And the library is located at 100 Larkin Street in San Francisco, and the event is free. So what you should do is get to the library before 2 o'clock, go upstairs to the third floor and check out the exhibit, and then, you know, mosey on back downstairs and get all cozy in the Corrett Auditorium for this wonderful, wonderful conversation and slide presentation of this fabulous spiritual journey to the heart, she calls it. And let me tell you a little bit about Ms. Lange. First, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Wanda.
Yeah, and then after you tell me you went to bed at 2 o'clock, I'm like,
well,
oh,
I mean, really, you know, you're laying down hoping you're in bed at 8 o'clock and you take a little nap and wake up in the middle of the night, oh, my God, I didn't do this, you know.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, I'm all set today.
Oh, that's excellent, excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
by the way, I wanted to tell you, this is more than it's not just not a lecture. It's what it is we're having all these wonderful a program with the Japanese playing the koto, which is a Japanese instrument. Tarika Lewis is playing it. They're all coming to just bring what we call a bridging of the culture. So we have Japanese artists and African-American artists together, African artists, poets who are doing haiku poetry, which is a Japanese-style poetry. So we're trying to bring the arts and our cultures together in that way. And at the end, I'm going to get up and talk about the program and what I hope it will mean to the African-American people who we tend to stay to ourselves, even though much of it has been forced on us. But now I think is the time to break out into other cultures, and that's what I'll be speaking to at the end of this program. So it's really going to be very nice.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a wonderful, afternoon of music and
yes,
conversation.
It is. It's going to be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really awesome. I really love the exhibit. I love the big pieces, you know, sort of your landscapes are just fabulous, and then I love the more intimate photographs of you meditating.
Yes, everybody picks that out, you know, because it's so, it's unusual. I'd forgotten how many photographs I'd given them, but they blew that one up. They blew up the ones they really liked, and I think the reason why is that is the essence of why I was in Japan. To every morning, I had to meditate and take that very position and try to find out what we call the answer to the question that the Buddhist poses to you. And some people, it takes 4 and 5 years to get the answer because it's so strange. It's a question they call that they answer to the monks that are studying there, and that is you cannot answer it with your mind because the ego has to be taken out completely, and it's a very intricate thing that they do. Everything must come from the heart. And so it's a very beautiful concept, but it took me 2 years of living with my heart to be able to answer the question. So, and it changes your life. There's no question about the moment that question is asked you, it's such a spiritual question. And mind you, there are 3,000 different questions to be asked, but only one answer. And so the object is you can't think about it. You can't go out to a library and look it up. You can't research anything because there's nothing that has to do with anything here on this earth. It has to do with just you and a coming together of your heart. So it's a very beautiful spiritual exercise, and everybody comes in different times. You may wait 1 year to get the answer, or 2 or 3, but you know when you have it. And it took me 2 years. And as I say, it changes your life. And by changing your life, I mean it takes you to another level of your very existence that you have to think about, that you... Believe it or not, we have so many things to think about that we don't, the really real reasons we're here, those are the things we don't think about. You know, nobody, you know, everybody's uncomfortable with a cocktail party. Why are we here? Anybody know where we came from? Do you know where you're going? No. Well, then you're not going to come back to that party. Yeah, you know, people like, it's an uncomfortable question, but at some point in your life, that's the essence of the changing your life, that if you do seek that answer and get it, it makes the rest of your life harmonious. Mm-hmm. Because it does answer a question that all of us have in the back of our minds and don't often think about. Trying to, you know, just think of a kid growing up thinking mom and dad knows everything, or certainly the President of the United States knows everything. Geniuses know everything, but they don't know where they came from, and they don't know where they're going. And it's frightening, and then you get kind of scared, you know. And so nobody, if you know that nobody, you go to cocktail parties or whatever you're going to, nobody's discussing that. And the reason they're not discussing it, because everybody knows no one has the answer. So that kind of thing, I had to give up any kind of fright of that kind of thing, not knowing what the question was. You have to go headlong in and say, okay, this is the journey I have to take. And everybody's not ready for it, but if you're ready for it, it's the most wonderful experience of your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me tell our audience a little bit about you before we talk about how the Master Zen Buddhist priest, Hoju Roshi, looked at the cover of your book, Jerry, A Black Woman's Life in the Media, mm-hmm. and told Yoshi, who is your friend,
yes.
from, I think she stayed with you.
Yes, she did. I was her host mother in Honolulu when she was studying English.
Right.
And I was there on television, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she shared the book with him, and mm-hmm. he looked at your photograph, and he said, she's ready. And so that began a journey.
Absolutely.
Where you went back and forth to Japan over the whole four seasons, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but he was the one that the last trip was his trip.
Oh,
this is
okay.
You know, she had been sending, and I'm going to read that to you. But the fact that she went back and was going to go back to college, and the way she was paying her way through is she was every summer she'd be a tour guide with these rich Japanese businessmen who went on safaris, they went to Africa, they went to Paris, they went all over the world, and she traveled, and that was a wonderful job for her as a student, and she saved up the mileage, and then that's how she sent me a ticket every other year. She would save up enough mileage on the tickets, you know, what we call frequent flyer mileage. That I have never paid to make one trip to Kyoto. Every trip was, and then when I went there, I stayed with her, so it never involved any expense on my part. And the last trip, the fourth trip, was the one where he saw the book, and she had become a Buddhist, and then he sent the ticket. He actually sent a ticket because I said, well, gee, I'm doing my publishing, and I don't really, you know, a trip to Japan is very expensive. And she called the next day and says, well, he'll send the ticket. And he sent the ticket and gave us a two-bedroom home on sacred ground inside a huge park, where people would go to visit the temples and things like that. They had to be off the grounds at 5 o'clock, so Yoshi used to look at me and say, Mrs. Lange, do you realize everybody, the Japanese people have to leave here at 5 o'clock? We're staying. It was so funny. Anyway, it was wonderful. And he wasn't one of those, not a pompous guy. You know, he could talk about deep spiritual things, but he was playful. So we had a lot of wonderful things, going to the hot baths and going shopping, and we went to go to get the Nikon camera for me, never dreaming that I was going to really do something with it. I just took my own photographing skills for granted. I mean, I hadn't really done that, but I'm beginning to find out from people that either you have that sight through that eye of the camera, and part of the thing is that why do we, you know, I knew Ansel Adams and the beautiful things he took. I didn't realize that part of you is in that photograph, how you take the picture, and that's what makes people like your pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, similar to, you know, your writing and your, you know, extensive and long journalism career,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's some elements of photography are parallel to those elements of just good writing.
Yeah,
yes. The composition.
Right.
You know, what's going to be, you know, the central focus you know, or the theme.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
so
right.
Since you know how to write, then, you know, it kind of makes sense that.
Yeah, and it does spill over, you know,
yeah.
And because the whole idea is that you have to, you know, I think, I believe in magic, and people don't understand what kind of magic I'm talking about. You see a person, for instance, this Academy Awards, I'm looking at the some people can go in with a camera and make movies that are absolutely magic. That we're talking about now, that little girl in that new movie that's coming out. She's just a small, that's come out, and she's going to be up for an Academy Award. Her performance is pure magic. She's only, what, about 10 or 11 years old, and she's up for an Academy Award.
You're talking about Beasts of a Southern Wild?
Exactly. I mean, that little girl's performance
is
magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a good writer... Because I know this is, I'm going to say something controversial, which a lot of people say, really? You know, and then all the writers know it. After a while, when you're writing sometime, some stuff will come out, and you'll get ready to type it on the word processor, wherever you're going, and it comes out, and it's profound, and you say, well, you know, I think I'm pretty smart. I'm not that smart. Somebody's channeling this, you know. And in the end, most people, even whether it doesn't matter whether they play an instrument or whatever it is, at some point in their lives, they recognize that something higher than them are playing through them or reading through them or writing through them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that's what I've come to feel. And then when I started studying about the difference for what happens when your ego, you literally get rid of your ego and say, well, I didn't do any of it. Well, that's what the great, you know, all these great composers in the 1800s, you know, Haydn and Beethoven, they always said, to God goes the glory. And they always knew that that music was what didn't come from them,
mm-hmm.
that they channeled it, that they were channeled from a higher source. And that's really what people call them muses, if you recall. They say, oh, I have to go consult with my muse. Well, my muse is the person who gives them their talent. But actually, you do begin, I personally believe, everything we do is something. Our charge is to keep the temple up and running and healthy and able to receive something higher above that comes to you, whether it's acting, whether it's singing, whether it's writing, whether it's poetry and photography. Absolutely true, because you take pictures and they are magic. I have some that weren't in there that I will show you one time later. I'm going to be putting in, when I put it in the galleries, of some more things with just the way the water's running, with the sun shining on it. And they didn't have room to put all the photographs in there, but when I saw those pictures, I didn't see that when I was pressing the camera. I didn't know it was overcast, but the sun was shining through. But when you took the picture and developed it, you saw the sun in the water, shining on the water. Mm-hmm. It was just magical.
Yeah. What's also really nice about the exhibit is that we learn about you, and mm-hmm. you have, you know, wonderful scrapbooks where we read articles from the Oakland Tribune
mm-hmm.
about, you know, your gig at KQED.
Yeah, yeah.
and then there are photographs with you, the only woman with all these men standing around you, these big important black men, you know, and I don't remember.
Let's see.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I better go back and look at that.
Yeah, it's in the same showcase as your the article by the Trib, and then we move around, because within each case, you know, there are two in particular that have some biographical information, but I really love the one where you have your father.
Isn't that
and
wonderful?
Your mother and your three sons.
Yeah.
And that is so sweet. And then a picture of you when you were like a little girl.
Yeah, I'm about 5 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the larger picture of you, I guess you were around 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember those kind of pictures because I've got one like that.
Don't you love those pictures? Because, you know, you're right in the middle of just becoming into the knowledge that, well, gee, I do exist, I'm in school. When you're 5 years old, you can't remember much.
Mm-hmm.
But 11 and 12, you're going into your teens,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, no, those were wonderful pictures. Mike, you know, my father was a Buffalo Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very proud of that because he taught me so many things that General Blackjack Pershing taught all of his soldiers, and it gives you a blueprint for how to live your life. And that was what I think he helped me an awful lot, and I speak about him in my book quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then your whole family's journey here from
New Orleans,
and you talk about you told me about it yesterday, but
yes.
Just your whole theory around New Orleans, and then your family. You also have real strong indigenous roots.
Oh yes, oh yes. You see, this we were born. See, when people don't realize that the only reason we have a black presence in Oakland is because of the Southern Pacific Railroad. There were no black people here at all. And then, of course, the Southern Pacific decided, they were building across from New York, the East Coast coming and developing the West Coast. So they said, well, we have to have a railroad now when we complete this. So the Southern Pacific came in, and they started, and they built a 16th Street station, which is still down there. It's a landmark, of course, historical landmark in West Oakland. That's where everybody from the East could come west, and that was where that train stopped. And remember the gold rush and all this that came out. So California was here, and it was just a lovely place. It was discovering gold and everything else. Well, they never would have brought black people here from the South. But what happened was they needed somebody to be sleeping car porters, chefs. They had to have red caps. They had to have a whole thing of people to service that station. And they decided to go to one place, New Orleans, to get them. And that's why everybody that came here back in the 1800s, when my grandmother came, these were the families of Lionel Wilson, Ron Dellums. I could just go on and on and on and name them. And everybody, we all knew each other because our people knew each other. Our grandparents knew each other probably back in New Orleans. And it was nothing but New Orleans black people for several years. And then after 1942, when black soldiers came here from the South, and they came here, came through this wonderful place and saw there were no signs saying where you could, you know, you could drink or go to the bathroom or you could sit, didn't have to integrate a counter, you could go anywhere for coffee. They loved it, and the weather they loved, and everybody. I remember when we used to entertain the soldiers down at Defemory Park, and they'd say, "Oh, when this war is over, we're coming back here." And almost every one of them, they discovered California, and that's when the big boom, the big exodus came here, because they're from their country, from the South, because they wanted to be free from all the restrictions,
mm-hmm.
And that's how this Bay Area grew up.
Yeah, yeah. Because you mentioned, you know, that in 1881, your grandparents Laura and Ewing Cohen came
yes.
to West Oakland from New Orleans and settled
mm-hmm.
down and had seven children.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that your mother clearly remembers going down to the Oakland Estuary to watch people injured in the 1906 earthquake and fire
mm-hmm.
arrive at the Oakland Estuary and be taken to Providence Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone thought it was the end of the world. And then you talk about going to the estuary in this favorite rock that you like, that you talk
yeah,
about in
London. Yeah, they're still there. And it's still there. They built the waterfront hotel now, and it's called Jack London Square, and it's got a big statue. But at that time, the smart thing they did is they did not destroy those rocks. It meant it was a beautiful foundation to build that hotel on. So I often went down there, and I said, gee, I remember when I first went, I said, gee, I hope they didn't do away with the rocks when we were doing all that building, and went down there and I looked underneath the hotel, and there those rocks were. They had, were on stilts.
Mm-hmm.
The hotel was kind of stilted up and propped up, but underneath it was, they built it on a solid foundation. I said, very smart, because when an earthquake comes, it'll really be a lot of protection for them. But they were the very rocks that we couldn't wait to run down there to the estuary. It was nothing there but those big brown stilts of fences, which are still there. They were smart to leave all that stuff there and then build around it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I go down there, and I see it's a wonderful place to meditate, because you keep, every time you go down there, you're making a full circle of where you used to play as a child at 4 or 5 or 6 years old with everybody, you know. We catch the pollywogs and put them in a glass jar in the water and bring them home, and so we had conquered the world.
Yeah,
it was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so You're 88 now, and
yes.
And these photographs reveal your life journey here in the San Francisco Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
along with moments as we've been talking about from
uh-huh.
Tokyo to Japan during your profound spiritual and life-changing studies and experiences
mm-hmm.
in 2006 under the auspices of Hoju Roshi, as we already mentioned,
yes.
Zen Buddhist priest, master Zen Buddhist priest.
Mm-hmm.
Your passion for learning about the cultures of the world and your love for the Japanese culture because of your experiences in Kyoto
mm-hmm.
have flourished throughout the years. And you use these passions to help people, especially young African Americans and other people of color, embrace the concept that we are all connected to the same source.
Yes.
And that education through school, reading, researching, and traveling will tremendously enhance their lives. And July 29, 2012, just last year, you received the prestigious Living Legend Award from the renowned Third Baptist Church in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
You are an award-winning journalist who, from 1969 to 1979, hosted community-based television shows in the Bay Area on KEMO, KBHK, KGO, and KQED, where you became the first black woman to host a national talk show, Turnabout, and where you served on the board. You've interviewed world leaders and great entertainers, including Professor Arno Toynbee, a historian from the Royal Institute of International Studies in London, Sammy Davis Jr., Rock Hudson, and many others. You were a professor at San Francisco State University and lectured at a graduate class in communications at Stanford University, and you were a correspondent in Africa for the San Francisco Chronicle and created and published the magazine Amber Star
mm-hmm.
in Hawaii, which we were talking about. That's where you met Yoshi.
Mm-hmm.
In your book, Jerry, A Black Woman's Life mm-hmm. in Media, which we mentioned earlier, you tell of your extraordinary experiences and how they shaped your life.
Mm-hmm.
So now I want to go back to your dad.
Oh, my dad.
Yeah, so your dad, you mentioned that that he is the son of a full-blooded Seminole Indian mother.
Yes.
And his father was a runaway
slave. A runaway slave.
Yeah. And the children of the marriage of escaped Africans and
recalcitrant
Indians
yes.
were a special breed.
Yes.
Talk about this memory that you talk about here of, like, your father has no memory of captivity.
What happens was, this is why the children, if you remember the Okefenokee Swamps, you remember they went to live in the Okefenokee Swamps in the Seminole Indians. First of all, the Seminole Indians are a merger between the Creek Indians. They're the Creek Indian tribe who intermarried with disappearing African slaves, ones who were able to come out of the South and move in with their, became Indians. They became Indians, literally. And they all went to live in the Okefenokee Swamps in Florida. Now think about this. Black people were living with alligators, snakes, everything else, because whatever magic, special magic they had, though, they could live in that swamp to run away from the white man, and they did not bother them. They lived together. And people don't like to talk about that because they don't understand it, but that's what happened. And so the white man got very upset because the slaves knew now they had some place to go, and they were running away. They were losing millions of dollars. And they finally found a way to get in there and burn it, torch it or something. That was the only way they got those slaves off those plantations, out of that creek that they were living in. And the point being that if you have a father who escaped slavery and never stayed on a plantation, and you have American Indians who were never enslaved, and then together with that blood went to live with alligators and snakes and everything else in order to have their freedom, then slavery is not really in your DNA the way it's in people's DNA, where you had to live with the master, live under the master. People don't realize it's that bloodline and that DNA that they keep exploiting, because that's your memory, and you're born with a memory of who you are. And we react to things without realizing, well, that's what your grandfather used to do. Well, of course. So these children were very special children. They were black, but they never understood that they were anything but free, because their ancestors were free. And that's a very poignant part to remember, because it actually decides how you perform as a black person in the world. And that's how I felt. I never felt anything about captivity. I just felt that I could do or be anything I wanted to. And when my parents said that I could, I did. That's how I taught my children. So it's a very poignant point I wanted to point out, that what slavery does to people is it comes through the bloodline. And that's why we have to be literally unbrainwashed of all of the things that were told us. We couldn't go to that place. We couldn't go in this place. You were always told what you couldn't do. And that's why in my book, when my counselor at Berkeley High, and Berkeley in the end, when I was had the grace to go into Cal, here they were with that one little thing. They didn't want black people to go onto a further education. So she said, well, there's really nothing for your people. And that was said at Berkeley High, three blocks from the University of California. She said, yes, you have the grades, but it'd be better for you to get a job and help people. You know what I mean? The whole thing. But that's when that came at me, that was like I was stunned. You know, I wasn't something, well, I was expecting it, because I all my life I thought I could do what I wanted to do and move up in the world. And the only way I could do that by doing the research is to find out it was the bloodlines. We didn't even think about slavery. We didn't have a memory of it. And we all carry the memories of everything, mm-hmm. You see? And so that was that point that I thought I should make that point, so that people could begin to unbrainwash themselves. Because you can come here, if you've got a past memory, coming to California is not going to erase some of the things that you feel inside, like not mixing with other races. That's why I wanted to bring open up, not just, I've traveled on four continents. Sweden, they were just as nice to me there. And sometimes we've heard these things that, well, people don't like black people. You know, they can tell you anything if you haven't been there. Well, let me tell you, I was treated absolutely beautifully everywhere I went. And I've been on the whole South American continent. I went down to Brazil. You know, I've been everywhere but China, really. I think that's the one place I haven't been. And everybody is very interested in you. They're wondering what you, you know, they want to talk to you about your, and they all have a respect for what black people, how we have existed in this country. And you'll never hear that and find out about how our race is revered around the world because they know that what we have endured. And the world is very, and then that's why they love our culture. I went to Paris. Everybody, did you know that Grace Kelly and Prince Rainier have one of the largest jazz collections in the world? And when I walked into Sweden at one of the clubs, I walked in, and I couldn't believe it. They were a bunch of Swedes, and they were playing Take the A Train. And now, you're not going to know that if you don't travel. Mm-hmm. You're going to say, my God, they love us. They love our music. Mm-hmm. That's why Josephine Baker went to Paris and was a smash hit, mm-hmm. Because people love them, and they love us. And we will never know that if we sit here having people tell us that they don't love us. And so one of the things I wanted to do was bring some of these school children in to see the exhibit in San Francisco, to see me walking around with a Buddhist monk who was teaching me. And not only that, sent my ticket to come. And then it gave me a place on sacred ground. I mean, you know, so I'm saying we didn't know who we were because somebody told us lies about who we were. And we come from and a lot of these people know who we are. Because they, you know, they're far and they read the information. They get, they know we come from greatness. That, you know, the things that we built, the pyramids. They know that we were told all kind of lies about ourselves. And so, I wanted to start at an early age so the kids wouldn't have to go through that. Let them come and see a black woman walking around being treated. These people treated me like a queen. I know one. I love to tell the story. I hate to tell the story because it's so, it's unbelievable. Maybe people won't believe me, but I used to hear Yoshi on the phone with Hoju Roshi every morning. He would call her up, and they would speak Japanese because that was what he spoke. So one day I said, "Well, Yoshi, what are you two talking about all the time?" She said, "He wants to know if you mentioned anything that you wanted because he wanted to make sure and bring it that day." Now that. Can you believe that? I mean, it's so beautiful. And that's how they treated, because they know what black people have gone through in this country. And that's what they did. And the fact that we have survived, this is how they want to repay you. And it's a beautiful thing, I'm telling you. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to have you on again to continue this conversation because it's so rich.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering, in closing, if you could talk a little bit about, I was reading, I had like two closing questions, and I'm like, okay, which one do I ask her about? Have her repeat the aha moment again, or ask her about how, I think in one of your narratives, you talk about how at 53, that black women should not feel embarrassed about taking care of themselves and pampering themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
And and then we see the picture of you in Japan,
mm-hmm.
you know, soaking in this
wonderful
body of water. It's like, look, you always see is your head. And it's like, oh, you look like you just totally relaxed.
Yes, and I just had this beautiful, it's out in the country, and I just had some of this, a lot of people get Japanese food. They don't really know there's another kind of Japanese food. It's a country style, mm-hmm. and only very few restaurants have it, and they bring all this fresh vegetable and meats and everything, and Hoju Roshi cooks it at the table, puts it in the hot water and steams it, and it's the most beautiful lunch in the world, and you have your lunch before you go in. So I was feeling absolutely fabulous, you know, and so I'm just saying they're all, it's, in other words, your life is so enriched when you can go in and embrace someone else's culture. And it adds to who you are, because you're not going to be the same person coming back. You're going to have added something to yourself. So with all of those wonderful things that were happening to me, I think I do want to mention this one thing that really was meant for me to go there, and that is the struggle with all of us is we don't know where we came from, but if we could just plug in, you know, and that's what I end my book in. If you know my book, the last pages, you can plug in. And the reason I knew that is because actually what plugging in is the answer to the question, to these 3,000 questions that the Buddha's asked, is we must transcend our body before X happens. And what that means is we came into this earth and separated from the source at the time of birth. And the one thing we're trying to do is find our way back to the source, but at a higher level. And all we have to do is we just feel that it's a shifting of consciousness. And that is what he gave me when I said he teached me to reach for the stars. This is what you can do. You literally can walk among the stars at some point. That's a metaphor, of course. But what it is you raise one level out of where you were when you were born. That's what the transcending means. It means a different consciousness, a different awareness of who you are. And travel helps you to have that, and that's why everybody should travel this earth, because you're going to get invited into people's homes, hear how they think, and you're going to say, well, my God, we're all from the same source. Well, of course we are. And knowing that, it to me, is the ultimate road to peace. You cannot go at war if you kill somebody who's part of you, and that's what none of the countries realize. It is still maintaining armies. We are every time you look at somebody, you're looking at yourself. Every time you kill someone, you're killing part of yourself. So that war is just, we have to learn how to transcend war. And so that's why my whole mission of this particular exhibit is going to be about, this is going to be a mission of peace.
Thank you. And want to mention to our audience that it's just so lovely that we have, you know, two mavericks in media,
mm-hmm.
on my show today, you know,
uh-huh.
back to back. I mean,
uh-huh.
first we, you know, we have you.
Yes, and that, what,
and
that marvelous Belva Davis?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this lady. Well, remember, she's the original. She's the pioneer. She was an original first black woman in the Bay Area to go into television. So she had to break down all those barriers. And then the Valerie Coleman came next, and I came third. And I always thank both of them for paving the way, because it made it easier for me. And that's what we can do for each other. And when we come together, we will come back with a tremendous amount of respect for our people and ourselves when you travel. Traveling is the key. And Belle was going to have all these wonderful celebrities at that place. I think it's just marvelous.
Yeah, it's going to be really great. So I pre-recorded an interview with her yesterday afternoon,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
we're going to play that. And, mm-hmm. and thank you so much for joining us today.
Mm-hmm.
And know that Sunday's program is going to be fabulous.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be great. It's going
to
be great.
Yeah, people need to get over to the San Francisco Public Library. Again, the exhibit, Jerry Lange's One Woman's Spiritual Journey to the Heart, Bridging the Cultures of the African American and Japanese People, is up until May 2nd, but Sunday's going to be really special.
It's going to be very special.
Yeah, 2 to 4 in the Corret Auditorium, which is in the lower level, and the library is located at 100 Larkin Street in San Francisco, and it's a free event. The library is right across the street from the Civic Center bar station. There's an exit that goes right up, and you come upstairs and just walk right across the street. Yeah, well, you have a good, wonderful day. And
I hope I'll see you Sunday.
Yeah, I'm going to pop through there so I can take in some of this wonderful program. Sounds really lovely.
And believe it or not, we have a jazz and champagne reception afterwards at an Ethiopian club and restaurant. So that's a fitting end, I think.
which one is that?
Well, it's called Rosella's.
Oh,
Jazz Club and Restaurant.
Yeah.
We're gonna that starts at 5:30 to 8:00. So I think it's a real nice touch to the end of a cultural event.
Yeah. It's so funny that John Handy is celebrating his 80th birthday.
I heard about that.
Right there on Fillmore at the Jazz Heritage Center, and then there's gonna be a concert at Yoshi's San Francisco, right next door, and then Rosales is right next door.
I know. It's going to be, my goodness, this is really, Black History Month, because we're really, but I think with a black president talking about there's no such thing as hyphenated, black Americans, Japanese Americans, and we're all Americans, and that's where I think we're headed.
Yeah, and when you travel, you know that because when you travel and you fill out that form on the airplane before you get off, it doesn't say, black American, it just says American.
That's when you realize it's the first time when I went to Paris and this man, I did never liked my whole name was Geraldine, I thought, oh, that's such a funny name. When I went to Paris and he opened up my passport and they always ask you your name, right? He says, Geraldine Berenice Lange. I said, oh, where is she? Who are you talking about? I said, my God, he made it sound beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that whole, that's called culture shock.
Yeah.
And, when you hear how people call your name, it's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Just to hear it in another language. So your whole mind, you really take a transcendent of your mind when you travel.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's a spiritual travel, it's the transcending of of your whole heart. You see, you have to transcend the body, which brings you from the, I'm going to take you on the longest journey you'll ever travel, from the head to the heart, because it's so difficult to get there. It's the one place we're afraid to go. But we must go there, because it keeps you alive, it keeps you well, it keeps you alert, it opens you up to greet people, not figure out, well, somebody's going to hurt me or enslave me. And that was the role the slavery did. Those people did that. The damage done to black people was in making us close down, afraid that someone was going to hurt us, that they didn't like us. And that has caused a lot of damage in the psyche now, which I think attributes to a lot of the shootings in the street of black on black, because people don't think much of who they are, so they don't mind shooting somebody who looks like them. We've got to change that, and we change it, but we have to change it inside our heart.
That's
with an aha moment. Oh, my God, I'm somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm not who they say I am. I am. But you have to, like you said, know yourself.
No, you have to know, I am what I am.
Mm-hmm.
And you are who you are, and we are who we are together.
Right, yeah. And
you can't get a man to go over and kill somebody that he doesn't know. You can't do it.
Yeah.
Once you're aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I say age stops being an age once you find that, because now you're living in eternity, so you're going to live forever one way or another. So, hey, I'm a baby again, which is fine.
True rebirth, huh?
It really is a rebirth. Well, the Bible's, you cannot, you have to become as a child, come in as a child, and you become somebody brand new. That's what the Bible says. So all these things are telling you who you are, but we didn't know what they meant.
Right. Well, let me play this interview, otherwise I'm not going to have enough time.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Right, thank you so much, Ms. Lynn.
Thank you so much, Wanda, and I'll see you Sunday.
All right, yes.
Bye-bye, dear.
Peace and blessings. Bye-bye. I just wanted to tell you that I have really been enjoying reading Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in General.
Oh.
Yeah, I rode over to the library on my bicycle on Monday to pick it up, and I'm almost done with it. And I just like, oh, my God, she met W.E.B. Du Bois. Oh, my goodness.
Not because I wanted to.
Yeah,
I said that right away.
Yeah.
I mean, now I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased. You know, all I wish now is that I had a photograph.
Mm-hmm,
but actually, because it was a Sunday afternoon and my boss made me do it.
Yeah, you've had some good bosses that made you do things.
Yes,
I'm like,
course,
oh, my goodness. And you were just like just stepping into it. I mean, like the whole thing around Jet Magazine, I'm like, oh, my gosh. I mean, getting one-on-one mentoring around your writing.
Wasn't that great?
Yeah. Fabulous.
Well, I just tell those stories for kids so that, you know, that anything is possible. I mean, how could I have known that he would, you know, not be with us that much longer and all of that stuff. So
take
your chances and, you know, do what you can do when you can do it.
Yeah, but I just can't get over, you know the little girl who wanted to be useful. And looking for a home and just being, you know, satisfied with, you know, literally almost like crumbs, because what you were looking for was something that's supposed to be provided for anyway.
Yes, yeah, I know.
You spend a lot of time on kitchen floors. My goodness.
Oh, dear. Well, anyhow, you know, I cannot say that that any of these experiences were not good for me, because after all, you know, my life depended upon what I learned along the way. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I see why Bill Cosby writes in the foreword about how, and also in many of the wonderful praise for your book, that to read your book and to survey your life is to learn so much about Black history and culture. But you're, you know, woman in journalism, you know, the first woman to do so many things, like to be on television and just sort of like the first that you did. And then when you and your husband sort of teamed up, the things that you all did. But just to learn about the history of the San Francisco Bay Area is so cool.
Well, I think that was one of the motivating reasons why I put the time and the effort into trying to do the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there is a thing when I was growing up that says that, you know, if you want your history accurately portrayed, then you have to get in there and record it.
Mm-hmm.
And to, you know, make a contribution that reflects what you think your culture and your people are all about. And so, anyway, I grew up with a lot of older, wiser people that said things to me that have resonated throughout my life, and I thank them so much for it.
Right, yeah. I just, you know, in your person, you're always the same. Whenever, you know, I'm in your company, your greeting is always warm. You're always, like, really present with me in that moment. And I just think that's just so wonderful because you're such a, you know, a public person, yet, you know, the interaction is so intimate, you know, between you and others that, you know, happen to be in the same vicinity with you. I remember it was really wonderful when I was able to come to your book reading and signing at the Jazz Heritage Center more recently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was really nice.
That was nice because it was a nice intimate room and I was talking to somebody that I admired greatly. So, you know, it's just great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I remember seeing you on a panel of wow women over at the
Gwen
Jewish
Mazur.
And I'm like, I mean, I was just so shocked when I saw your name on the list of women. You know, like Mimi Silver, like, really? She's really?
Yay.
Like, over 65? Like, for real?
Broke out of the stereotype, huh?
Yeah. And you were talking about, you know, sort of that public persona and sort of because you're on television, you know, sort of how you had to stay current, you know, visually, and what you decide, okay, this is what I'm going to do and this is not what I'm going to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, integrity while being in public life is really one of those things that you have to constantly remind yourself of what you believe, what you think, and what represents you. afraid of or ashamed of in years to come. I mean, you can't really forecast all of that, but you have to keep it in the back of your mind when you're making your daily decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was speaking to Ms. Ruth Beckford, and she was talking about sort of a symposium lunch that she's hosting.
Oh.
That you're in. You're on, I think you're one of the guests.
I am on the panel. She talked me into it. I told her I didn't want to advertise that the way that she's doing it, but it's true, so let's just move on with it.
Yeah, so I know that's March. Do you remember the date?
You know, it's in May.
Oh, is it May? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but I don't remember the
date. Oh, that's
date,
okay.
But it's
I can...
coming up in the, about the second week of May.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and it's going to be at Jeffrey's, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so she was mentioning how, you know, you've been retired, I don't know, what, 2-3 months now or something?
Yeah, but I don't know if I would legitimately say I've been retired. But I'm on my way. March is my real month.
Oh, okay.
To sit back and have some reflect time.
Mm-hmm.
I really am counting on that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when I was reading your book, I was like, okay, I've got some questions, but I just want to know about a couple of folks. Like James Baldwin, like, oh, my goodness, tell me about him.
Oh, he had all the magnetism and the charm and that one would expect for someone with his ability to communicate the way that he did and still communicates with us,
mm-hmm.
with words that just resonate with, you know, when you go away from it, it stays with you.
Mm-hmm.
And where I saw him most intimately, there used to be a private club in Oakland called the Rainbow Sign.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
A,
yeah,
I came for a Sunday a salon,
mm.
you know, where he could sit and just, you know, talk and be himself, and we could all be there at his feet admiringly.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank Marianne Powered for the experience of seeing so many wonderful people in that setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I just love your story about Malcolm X. Well, back to Baldwin really quickly. I'm teaching his The Fire next time in my critical thinking class.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw it, I was like, oh, my God, James Baldwin, for real?
Yeah, well, you know, because he lived in France, he wasn't around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came, it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you talk about Malcolm X coming into your office, like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I think I was at the end of a joke on that one. I cannot think of any other reason. So I've just rationed it out over the years, you know, tried to rationalize why he would go through that exercise. And I said, even great men have to have fun sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Totally, totally, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Alex Haley, I mean, you all were, like, tight.
Yeah, we were pretty cool. You know, if we get invited to his house in Jamaica and
mm-hmm.
stay overnight and all that. But that was because I performed a service for him when he was traveling and writing and lonely.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be on a steamer someplace, you know, freighter, and trying to just every now and then keep touch with the reality of what was going on at home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did, just almost like a private newscast for him.
Oh, nice, nice.
I just recapture whatever was in the news that day and tell him what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that is so wonderful, yeah. And I went to Gambia a few years ago.
Wow,
and I went,
I've never been to Gambia.
Oh,
I'd
and
love
you,
to go.
Yeah, and Jufre, which is the island where his folks are, and you know, they have women kings
mm-hmm.
there, and so I met some of his relatives. One had just passed, like the oldest relative
mm-hmm.
had just passed, but they were so happy because Obama had, it was his first term,
yes.
and they were
yes.
like, I was the only American. Every time I was going somewhere on that particular trip, I was the only American.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, Obama! They were so excited.
Yeah. As well, we still ought to be, because
mm-hmm.
it's still history.
Oh, yeah, certainly,
yeah.
certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that story that you tell about being with Senator Feinstein and some other guests and having to say something.
Oh.
Yeah, I got all choked up, too.
Yeah. So that was a night that to be remembered forever.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I tell you how you never know when something happens. It ends up being like the biggest blessing about having her aide, Christopher,
mm-hmm.
you know, invite me into the hall for a hug.
Yes.
I mean, that just makes me, that brings a human element, you know, right into the story.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, certainly. But, you know, sort of... you know, throughout, you know, your story that you share with us, you know, in your book, it's, you just seem to be right there to take that risk, quit this job, move to something else, volunteer for this. And I just love the way you open the book with this, oh my, I had to read it like three times. What the hell are you in doing it in? I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, it really happened.
I mean, like things flying by you that could hurt you like really badly.
Yeah. But I really should have made more of the fact that the man who I was working with
mm-hmm.
was absolutely brilliant and such a great person,
yeah.
you know, to take time with an undegreed person.
Mm-hmm.
And that showed some confidence in me that he would set aside his time
mm-hmm.
To deal with me. So, you know, I the things I write about, I sort of hope that they'll become examples to others
mm-hmm.
That, you know, you're brilliant, and don't make a judgment on a piece of paper. Make a judgment on the person in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Help them when you can, because you never know what a difference it's going to make.
Right, yeah, yeah. But then you also mentioned, you know, Mr. Louis Freeman. You
That's
know?
What I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about,
right.
Louis Freeman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you would only volunteer.
Yeah. That's true. Who else wanted to go to old cold San Francisco for free
mm-hmm.
and spend half the night chasing around with some people that didn't like you
mm-hmm.
in the first place? Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was wondering when you mentioned H.L. Mencken that he observed that let's see, what do you say here? You say, the satirist H.L. Mencken once observed that a national political convention often is as fascinating as a revival or a hanging.
Yes.
One sits through long sessions wishing heartily that all the delegates and alternates were dead and in hell. And then suddenly there comes a show so gaudy and hilarious, so melodramatic and obscene, so unimaginably exhilarating and preposterous that one lives a gorgeous year in an hour.
Yep. Wasn't that great writing?
Very
nice. I kept that because as an example of really creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
You really got it.
Mm-hmm. But I was thinking about Richard Wright, you know, when he writes in Black Boy and he writes, you know, how he was working in Chicago and
mm-hmm.
he couldn't use a library.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about libraries too, particularly when you were in Alameda for a minute,
yeah.
Going to Lincoln, I guess, elementary school or something?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, back to Richard Wright, he writes himself notes and he first he borrows his boss's library card, and then he I think one of the books he checks out is by Mencken,
mm-hmm.
and so I thought about Richard Wright when I saw this. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your audacity to do the things that you did. I mean, you had no one to say, okay, I want to be like so-and-so. It's like there was no so-and-so.
Well, I had a mosaic of people. I mean,
mm.
there was always a woman named Taria Hall Pittman who was on the radio doing Negroes in the News.
Mm-hmm.
She was my example that women could deliver the news, you know, even as partisan as hers had to be when you have a program called Negroes in the News. But she was a broadcaster,
mm-hmm.
at least, you know.
Yeah.
And then I had women at the Black newspapers who were good writers and who were brave in what they were willing to say about the politics of the time. So I had some examples. I just had nobody on television.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the kinds of things that I ended up doing on radio, that was also, you know, new. I mean, I ended up, which I don't make a big deal of because it wasn't that big a deal, but integrating the major market, you know, our the white radio stations. I think.
Mm-hmm.
Took a job at KNEW.
Right.
And went through that process. But it wasn't so dramatic or traumatic because it was radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then when the Independent was not a Black newspaper, I mean, although you wrote for Black papers like the Sun Reporter,
And yeah, I thought
the Independent was a black news, black owned.
Oh, the black newspaper.
Black
oh.
owned newspaper.
Oh, I didn't
yeah,
know that.
Yeah,
oh,
owned
okay.
By, owned by a nice Republican black man.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Don Welcher. He was very much black, but he was
mm-hmm.
very much, you know, a conservative guy.
Mhm. Yeah, yeah. But then, I mean, it just seemed like there. It's like your life, the way you know, you seem to be prepared for the next step and the next step, even though it didn't seem like, you know, when you were stepping into a new mm-hmm. role, like, you know, when you started your show, I mean, that was like amazing.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and
you know,
yeah.
and it took a couple of women scheming to figure out how to get it done, and that's the way it is in life, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah.
You just think about, well, if that's not the normal path, what else can I do?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and then, you know, how, you know, you wanted to move from the things that are more, you know, women talked about and wrote about, you wanted to, you know, look at more the politics, so you had your column,
mm-hmm.
you had your radio show, you had, like, you know, you're working on multiple platforms.
Right,
as
how did I know it?
mm-hmm.
You know, there I was, had my little connection with Jet Magazine and
mm-hmm.
my black newspapers and my little black radio show, and, you know, next thing nowadays, that would be put into some sort of glamorous terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you know, you were a wife.
Yeah, I couldn't live off of any of it.
Yeah.
I had to have part-time jobs to,
mm-hmm.
to support it all.
And I love the tomato story.
Oh. Yeah, my kids, we tease and laugh about that.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah, and then you know, you write about, you know, the discrimination that you experience. I guess at Berkeley High School, you know, when you were on the bowling league.
Yes, but, you know, it wasn't really Berkeley High. It was the Berkeley Bowl. Berkeley High staff came through.
Oh, no, yeah, but you were a student at Berkeley High.
Oh, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I was a student there.
Mm-hmm.
But they came through, and, I, you know, there was nothing. Well, that was their first test of facing raw discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say they did all the right things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and each time, you know, something like that would happen, we'd see a lesson, like, okay, you don't just let it go,
mm-hmm.
because you told your teacher,
mm-hmm.
and then they, you know, affect, you know, they follow through on that, and because it was going to hurt them economically,
mm-hmm.
they changed.
And it's, you know, that same formula would work today.
Mm-hmm. Right,
but
yeah.
We're still using it in terms of boycotts,
mm-hmm.
you know. So.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I love the section on boycotts. I mean, how interesting to go into a store, fill your basket,
mm-hmm.
have them check it out, and then say, okay, I will purchase this when you have more black people.
Right. That was a tactic that those young kids used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's we need to hang on to the fact that there are others have already pioneered the way, you know, on the road to freedom for us, and
mm-hmm.
pick up the pieces with more people that are standing around waiting on something to be delivered to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because your book really points out that, you know, you're a Southerner by birth. I mean, you were born in Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
And you came here when you were, what, five or so?
Mm-hmm. No, I was a little bit older because I was in grammar school. I was,
okay.
You know, I was went to Prescott Elementary when I first came here.
Mm-hmm. Good old Prescott.
Yeah. Right. And so, no, I was in school. I think I was like maybe 7 or 8 years old, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you met up with, you know, you met up with your mother and father, and I guess was your little brother on the train with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he had a seat, and you're the one that sat on the suitcase the whole trip.
Yeah.
That sounds so painful. Like your butt must have been heck sore.
Well, as a little kid, you know, it wasn't a big punishment,
mm-hmm.
but it was exciting to be on the trip. Except it was tiring as the dickens.
Mm-hmm.
And we were so excited that we were going to see the rest of our family anyway.
Mhm. Yeah. Your family really sounded really interesting. I mean, you could write a book just about your parents and your extended family that you know, came and left and came and stayed. And
we're just like you know, I know that you have probably read The Great Migration, but
mm-hmm.
we were just very much like people that are in The Great Migration.
Mhm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on the 150th anniversary year of the Emancipation Proclamation and the 50th anniversary of the year of Martin King's I Have a Dream speech, and you met Martin King, I'm like, oh, my God, no, she didn't.
Wasn't that a privilege?
Oh, my gosh,
really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I will never forget, you know, just that one, isn't it funny, of all the things that were said and done, but that one throwaway line, I call it, mm-hmm. of Frank Clark's, when he says, "You know Martin, don't you?" I'm thinking, nope.
Yeah. You have a lot of great lines in your book. It's like, ooh, I'm just like annotating it like crazy. It's like, oh, this is so beautiful. I need to make a poster out of this one. Yeah. I was wondering, you know, your life has and career spans many social movements that you talk about, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act, free speech movement, and you were like on the front line, the Black Power Movement.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, how do you measure the distance traveled, and what do you see as our current task as a nation and as Black women and Black people?
Remembering what we've accomplished
mm-hmm.
to give us the courage to finish the job.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that if you really look at the history of the struggle, starting, you know, those many years ago, and what people went through, what they did, and how they sacrificed, and feel some obligation to pick up the ball and finish the job.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope to live long enough to see that kind of energy thrown back into, you know, glorifying the greatness of people who came from, you know, the, as someone used to say, the mother home.
Mm-hmm.
And just know it's more difficult today because some of the underpinnings of my generation aren't there as they were then. We were just getting the laws and the rights, and the people in this country were feeling it was time to make changes. I mean, the general population, not just Black people.
Mm-hmm.
So so that undergirding isn't there. But the history of what's past is there. So we just have to, again, find our voice and go ahead and finish up what the Martin Kings and Du Boises had in mind for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about how you just, we spoke about, you know, how you you had, you know, all these multiple careers happening simultaneously, and a lot of times they weren't necessarily supporting you, and so you had to be creative around that.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk about sort of how, you know, you juggled, you know, being a mother, being a wife, and then being a single mother, and I mean, like when you're your children's father, you know, your mm-hmm. ex-husband, mm-hmm. that was really scary. I mean, but you just sort of really play down the scariness of that. I mean, like, you walk into your apartment and there's somebody sitting in a chair like, how did he get in here? Like, oh my God, does he have a gun? I need to be cool here.
It was worse than that.
Mm.
The man was under my bed.
Oh, yeah. That is worse.
Rose up from out of the shadow.
Mm.
So it was scary.
Mm-hmm.
It was scary. It was meant to be what it was.
Yeah.
You know, frightening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, I mean, within the tone of the book is so up and it's so positive, yet, you know, there are those moments, you know, that are like, oh, my goodness, wow, and oh, my goodness. You know, it's like, some really scary stuff, just like I mentioned in the first chapter. But you all walk through it.
Yeah.
And you don't start crying, and you know, it's like, and you keep your face composed, and you don't let anything undo your form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not while anybody's looking anyway.
Yeah. So how do you do that? Did you do that?
I can't say. I mean, I did have more of a motivation than most people would have, because I knew I was that I was representing
mm-hmm.
people who had really made big time sacrifices, and I didn't want to let anybody down.
Mm.
You know, I felt a real strong calling to be the kind of person that was worthy of what they were trying to accomplish, and the feeling ought to still be the same today.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I like the line that Mrs. Cosby says, that when she would watch you on television, she'd say, "That's the most relaxed woman I've ever seen, and looking perfect." Yeah, it's really nice. And I love watching your This Week in Northern California. Mm-hmm. I would like, you know, watching that every week just to see, okay, make sure I didn't miss anything. And then your, you know, your guests. And I really love that you had Andrea Lewis on lots of times because,
yeah,
you know, we really miss her. And that was just so nice. It's like, oh, I know her. That was really lovely.
Well, I got to build a whole new existence now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how does one do that?
I don't know. This is just the way the rest of life has been, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You just put yourself out there and look around and make sure you don't ignore, you know, some obvious opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this next period is going to be about.
Yeah, yeah. I just think about, you know, when you talk about, you know, your good friend that you met at Prescott, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Rosemary. And
oh,
then,
no, we met at Hoover Junior High.
Hoover, okay, yeah, yeah. And how she helped you, you know, direct, like, you got a slot to direct a show, but you had never directed a show. That's like, I'm like, you just like some woman, like, look at you. And so you go to the library, you get the information, you figure it out, and then you go do it. And then that's when they say, oh, we need to put her in front of the camera. Like, oh, my gosh.
Well, see, all you got to do now is go to Google. I wouldn't have had to go anywhere. So it's easier.
yeah, but, you know, you were so creative in, you know, like you wanted to go to college, but, you know, you didn't have the money because you were helping your family, and then you got married. But, you know, you still didn't let that slow you down.
Well, it slowed me down, but you just bounce back up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You really do. What are you going to do? You're either going to sit there and wallow in self-pity, or you're going to get up and do something and take a chance on being happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's just so interesting how, you know, you started out just writing these little short pieces, you know, in the community paper,
mm-hmm.
and then that moved into something else and into something else, and mm-hmm. then, you know, before we know it, you know, you are hosting this great show, and then I just like the beauty contest. I didn't know about the beauty, the Black Beauty Contest, Miss.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Can you talk a little bit about that? That sounds like, wow.
Well, you know, it was my soft way of tackling a really very important and serious project. I mean,
mm-hmm.
problem. And that is that they're, you know, in terms of judging the beauty and the value of women,
mm-hmm.
Miss America pageant decided that we didn't qualify, that we were barred. They had it in their constitution that, that only white women
mm-hmm.
were eligible. And I just wanted to show them that there were dark-skinned women who were just as talented, just as lovely. So the only way you could do that was to show them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined with a friend whose idea this was and just picked up the northern part of California, going north, starting it down around Fresno, and produced pageants in Sacramento and Modesto and San Francisco. And turned out just to be a valuable thing because so many wonderful young women came forth, and many of them became big successes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, in fact, this weekend, a couple of the Miss Bronze girls are going to be there.
Oh, super.
So,
oh, wonderful.
Looking forward to that, too. And,
oh, that's going to be so great.
The main photographer for it is a guy who was the founder of the Fifth Dimension
Mm-hmm.
Entertainment group, Lamont McLemore.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be there too.
Oh, who else is going to be there?
Oh, well, let's see now. Everybody is a star in my book, but one, Danny Glover will be there,
mm-hmm.
of course. But and many of my media friends, not many, but a
mm-hmm.
number of my media friends from
mm-hmm.
across the country.
Yeah.
Will be there.
Is Nancy Wilson going to be there?
She can't. Yesterday was her birthday.
Oh, how lovely.
So she had a big celebration, I guess. I don't know how big it was, but
mm-hmm.
celebration down in Los Angeles last night. And
mm-hmm.
just isn't going to be able to travel to get up here.
Okay. Yeah.
I wish she was. I sure tried.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But
wow.
At this point, what you have to realize is what you can do comfortably, you do, and what you can't, you don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. You seem to have, your career sort of spoken to everyone that It's like, wow. And then some people are no longer with us, which is really, you know, so happy that, you know, that you were able to like document some of those conversations, even people that you didn't necessarily agree with.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like your story of Frank Sinatra. That's a really nice story.
Well, that's a nice story, whether I was, you know, black or white, to have had private time with a guy of his reputation and talent.
Mm-hmm.
It was really one of the, you know, high points of my recalls of my life experiences.
Mm-hmm.
It was just one of those things. You know, sometimes we talk about color, you know, barring us from opportunities, and sometimes it opens the door.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that the reason I was picked out is I was female and I was black, and everybody else out there was white and male.
Mm-hmm.
So I stood out.
Yeah, yeah. But what I like about this story is about how, you know, he spoke to you about how he was also nervous before he stepped on stage.
Oh, boy, that was so helpful
mm-hmm.
to me. I don't know whether you've had that life experience where somebody said something that just resonated with you
mm-hmm.
and stayed with you and when you're in tight moments and helped you, you know, get through them.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think when I was nervous, well, it's perfectly all right. Because he said so.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I was wondering if you could talk, I've got a couple more questions, about you know, you mentioned some of the significant women, you know, like the woman who was the news, she did a news segment, and then she was getting married, and her husband wanted her to stay at home, and so that's you stepped into.
You know, that's a story has more depth.
Mm-hmm.
The woman who was leaving because she was having a child was married to the California Supreme Court Justice the man who eventually became the Chief Justice. Excuse me, just a second.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you can edit. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was Odessa Broussard,
mm-hmm.
whose husband was Alan Broussard,
mm-hmm.
who became, I think he might have been, if not the first, the second black appointed to the California Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see by his statue, you know, he would want his wife to be home with their children.
Right.
And so she was just a wonderful contact. I mean, of inviting me and getting me into the station, which was supposedly a temporary job, until she came back. And, of course, then she decided not to come back.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then your friend who hosted these really nice salons, and you were just one of two women. The hostess is one, and you're the other.
Unless you're talking Lillian Fortier, who is my buddy through
mm-hmm.
poverty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. She's the one, the woman I'm thinking of is the one who'd have, like, former Congressman Ron Dellums, you know, former mayor of Oakland. He was there, and then she had, like, just sort of, like, these real powerful people would come through, and you mentioned how you were there, and you didn't speak much, but you just...
That was Edith Austin.
Yes.
Yes, she had her Sunday brunches for what she called her horses. and it would just, you know, these group of bright young males, Henry Ramsey, who became a, you know, judge, high-ranking judge, appellate court, I think he got to, you know, Ron Dellums was there, Paul Cobb, I mean, all these men who went
mm-hmm.
on to do other things. It was her way of bringing them together to make some collective decisions that were good for our community.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a political columnist for the Sun Reporter and one of my mentors.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only woman she ever invited. And I knew that I wasn't invited there because I knew something. I was invited there so that I could learn something. So
mm-hmm.
I would just sit and listen as they discussed politics. And out of, you know, the seeds of that produced Congressman Ron Dellums.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And I want to drop some more names. Ray Charles came to your studio.
Well, he
did not.
No, he didn't?
We went to him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you talk about lugging your big, all your equipment sounded really heavy.
Yeah, it was. Everything was bulky back then.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing was like you know, pick up a little tape in your hand. You had these big, I don't know what you call it, machines, reel-to-reel tape,
mm-hmm.
Cumbersome, difficult to edit, all of those things. But they were the equipment of the day, so you just learned to use it and utilize it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But so it wasn't as easy to get out, although I did finally get a tape recorder when I started interviewing jazz artists that were appearing around town. I had a little, not little, it was heavy, tape recorder I'd take out with me
mm-hmm.
to various venues, you know, where major people were appearing, and then catch them between sets backstage and do interviews with them that I'd run on my Saturday show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I like your, you're talking about, you know, your stand at K-Jazz.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't the DJ there. I was mm-hmm. the music person
right.
behind the scenes. But
mm-hmm.
but having access to the knowledge and the experience of listening and being part of that that absolutely wonderful period for K-Jazz
mm-hmm.
Really served me well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you go about, because when I read the book, I'm like, how does she remember all that?
I am about out of time.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yes, I am.
Oh, darn.
Sorry.
Okay. Like all the way out of time? We have like maybe 1 minute?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering sort of in closing if maybe, I was thinking if you wanted to maybe do a shout out to the women that nurtured you in your development, you know, like your Aunt Pearline, you know, like your first mother who passed when you were really young, and that was the end of your idyllic childhood, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, all I can say is thank you for the contributions that they made, because they were the building blocks for whatever has been produced.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my associations, growing up, were not many were that long term because of just life,
mm-hmm.
you know, death and moving and all of that. But the gifts they gave me have stayed with me. I still have some of my Aunt Pearline's dishes that I get to use on holidays.
Nice.
Unfortunately, my first mom passed away when I was quite young, and
mm-hmm.
and we left Louisiana, and I don't have many memories of her in terms of material things. But all of them along the way gave me the best of what they could offer. My aunt, a big respect for religion and God and church, and my first mom was just the most elegant woman, looking at her photographs now. Not that I could remember all of that, but I remembered her and her warmth, and I can look at the pictures of how she lived. And, you know, I must have picked up something from that. So every person that I came in contact with gave me a gift, and I think we should all remember that as we're nurturing young people, that's what you're doing. You're giving them the building blocks, giving them the gifts, to turn out to be the kind of people that will be useful in the world, we hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Well, I want to thank you so much for what you've done to make our lives so much better than they could have been if you weren't present. And thank you so much for being one of the founders of the Black Women Organized for Political Action.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's been great talking with you.
Great talking to you, too, and look forward to being at your celebration on Saturday.
Okay. Thank you.
Cheer you up. Congratulations.
Thank you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Belva Davis speaking about her career and her wonderful book, which I encourage everyone to get, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. And she is going to be saluted tomorrow, February 23rd, 7 o'clock at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, the Forum. General admission is about $55. And the host committee is up to $1,000, $250, $500, and $1,000. And the money raised is going to help fund a journalism scholarship in her name and a project to digitize and house Belva Davis's papers at San Francisco State University. So it's a great cause. And just in case people don't know who she is, she's been a fixture in Bay Area journalism for more than 5 decades. And since becoming the first black female television journalist in the West in 1964, she has covered events of local, national, and international scope, interviewed U.S. presidents, I believe four, and other world leaders. She talks about her, or we see photographs of her with President of Cuba, Fidel Castro. For the past 19 years, she served as host of KQED's much-watched public affairs program This Week in Northern California. And she announced her retirement from broadcasting last year and signed off the air on November 9th. So all the folks, you know, are going to be in the house at your Buena Center for the Arts on Saturday. And that's going to really be for the Alamo. And the I'm trying to think. I'm not so old. I think Danny Glover is hosting, but I think former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, a friend of hers, is going to be hosting. But I just want to correct something I said. Actually, it wasn't a president. It was chiefs. So Alex Haley's relatives, there's a chief there in Gambia. They have women chiefs, and if you know anything about Africa, there aren't that many women chiefs. So there are women chiefs there, and I met one. Actually, I met two, which was really exciting. And we'll talk more, and look for my review of her book. She talks about meeting Martin King again during the time of the protests against the Vietnam, United States involvement in Vietnam. And Joan Baez was in prison. She had gotten 3 months. The first time she only got a week. The second time she was arrested, she got 3 months. And so on January 14th, 1968, Belva Davis was at the prison where she was in, I think, in Pleasanton. And it was drizzling, and her hair was getting fizzy, you know, the way black women's hair gets fizzy. And she was there, and Martin King was there in the car, and he wasn't able to get in. And then finally, after being there for quite a bit of the day, he did get in. And so when he came back out, they had a little press conference, and she says that she jumped right in with a question that she had carefully crafted in her head to tease some new insight out of the off quoted reverend. And so she asked him, can you explain what you're quoted as saying, that you're for escalated nonviolence? What do you mean by that? So Martin King said, well, he replied, I made it very clear that the anger of our ghettos is very extensive and the bitterness is very deep. And in order to give that understandable anger a kind of creative and constructive expression, we've got to escalate nonviolence to the point that we make it much more militant, much more demanding, much more insistent, even if it takes on the dimensions of civil disobedience. Nonviolence, he added, must now be strong enough to be an alternative, both to those who wanted to block change altogether and those so desperate for change that they could be lured into violent revolt. And she says that this soundbite was the lead in her evening news, but it was also picked up by the national media. And then 4 months later, Martin King was struck down by assassin's bullet in Memphis. I have a wonderful guest who has been just waiting in the green room. And so I'm going to welcome on the air Terry Simmons, who is the music director at St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church in Berkeley, California. We had the pastor on the air last week, and we talked for over an hour. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for hanging in there, and thanks for still joining us, even though, you were supposed to join us, about almost 20 minutes ago, and I kept on saying, okay, I'm not.
Oh, that was great. Belva Davis was our guest speaker at our Black History Program here at the Federal Building last year. So I got a chance to get a picture with her in her book and everything, so it was fascinating listening to her.
Oh, nice. Yeah. You have to send me a copy of that. It'd be great to put up, you know, for this programming recap.
I feel I can find it because they framed it. Yes, okay.
Oh, lovely, yes. Lovely. Yeah, yeah. And you're a native Oakland, California, and for over 30 years, you provided music program leadership for many churches throughout the San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, you're always running and running, you know, to rehearse this choir or rehearse that choir.
Yeah, that's my life.
Yeah, yeah. And you've written over 200 compositions. I'm like, oh, my goodness. That is amazing.
They're not all out, but I've written them. They're somewhere.
that's wow. That's a lot. That's
God. Yeah, that's God.
That's tremendous. I mean, because the compositions of yours that I've listened to are just beautiful. I mean, they are just so fantastic. And then the you know, the various choirs that are singing are just, their voices are so lovely. Yeah, I guess it just speaks to how great a teacher you are and a great an orchestra leader you are, a choir leader you are. You've been a workshop presenter and traveled throughout the United States as guest organist and pianist for many choirs and artists, and you received numerous awards and certificates. You also produced two sound recordings featuring your original compositions performed at by your chorale with Renewed Faith. And you attended Oakwood College, Huntsville, is it in Huntsville, Alabama?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Wow. Well, you majored in business administration and music. Wow. Well, welcome, welcome. So tell
Thank
us,
you.
Tell us about your this concert that's coming up Sunday.
Well, this Sunday at 4 p.m., we're having our second annual Healing Body and Soul Benefit Concert. And this concert is benefiting humanitarian efforts in the fight against AIDS, hunger, relief, and education in the Virgin Islands, Dominican Republic, Haiti, etc. This is part of the extended African Methodist Episcopal outreach in their ministry that they do. We're raising funds to support those types of activities, as well as some local things, too. But basically, we focus on the outreach and the missionary efforts that are going on. We're having several groups that were with us last year. They asked to come back. That's how great this community of Berkeley and Oakland is. They said, Terry, we're coming. Are we going to do this again? We're featuring the Oakland Youth Chorus with Linnell Martin, who's been with them for a while. By the way, I play for the majority of these groups.
Really?
I play on a you know, as needed. And we have the Oakland Bay Area Community Chorus, which is directed by Professor William Bell, who used to be one of the professors, the band director there at the College of Alameda. Mm-hmm. And their focus, of course, is going to be the preservation of gospel spirituals and such. We have the Berkeley High Jazz, which is the Berkeley High School Jazz Band, which is fantastic. They are just, you think that you're at Yoshi's, they're so good, under the direction of Sarah Klein. And the University of California Berkeley Gospel Choir, under the direction of Dr. D. Mark Wilson. And they were with us last year as well. And also going to have the East Bay Joint Mass Choir, which is my own personal group, and members of St. Paul, members of the McGee Avenue Baptist Church in Berkeley, members of the Elmhurst Seventh-day Adventist Church, where I actually have my church membership. We're just a good group of people that just like to sing and like to share in efforts to raise funds for whatever may be needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about your artistry and your you know, your creative work. Because you're a wonderful pianist and composer. Talk about, you know, sort of your creative life, how long you've been writing, you know, how does one write 200 songs? So how do you do that? And
well, I'm making sure I'm not gonna be like the pastor. He took some of my time last week, but what I didn't share with you, because I just didn't think about it, and that was, like, I was born and raised in Oakland. Mm-hmm. I've always been a resident of Oakland.
Okay.
I was listening to Belva Davis say Prescott. I attended preschool at Prescott, and I grew up across the, right on 853 Willow Street in West Oakland. And my father, who actually went to school with John Handy, believe it or not.
Really?
My father's a saxophone player, and he along with Ed Kelly and and a few others all went to a conservatory that was located at Best Music on in downtown Oakland, and Candale. It was Candale. I can't think of conservatory, and it was downstairs in the basement of Best Music at that time. And he was a saxophonist, and he was a jazz saxophonist. He plays like Coltrane type of music. And he got converted into Christianity, and he became what the what our church known as the converted saxophone player. And he was just he wasn't around much because he was out, you know. But my mom and dad were kind of in and out all most of my life. So my great grandmother actually raised me and my brother and sister. But my dad was around, and my I kind of just was there in West Oakland. But my dad, because he got converted, he wanted us to go to a Christian school. So we wound up going to Golden Gate Academy, which is a Seventh-day Adventist school, which is out of the Oakland. It's up by College of the Holy Names. And
that's exactly where that is. I actually graduated from Holy Names College.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, as you go up toward the college, there it is on the right side.
Correct, right, behind, kind of like in the back. And I, in fact, I attended there from first grade through 12th. I graduated from there.
It's a black school, right?
No, it was at Seventh-day Adventist School.
It's a
church school. Now it is. Now it's a charter school, a music, a charter music school.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and what wound up happening, my godmother who lived next door had a beauty shop called Ebony Beauty Shop in those days. And she was a member of Taylor Memorial, which is one of those historic black churches in Oakland as well. And I used to, she was a pianist, but she attended church and rehearsal. And I was just fascinated at watching the organist play when I was young, 8, 9, 10, attending rehearsals with her. And she decided to give me lessons with the organist there, who's Roshan Hemmons, who is still my mentor, even now, and also another music instructor, Susie Middlebrook. I don't know if she's still living now. When I was 10, I started taking piano lessons because of my godmother. And things happened, and I kind of like didn't take very much, maybe a year or two. But I was always in church. My great-grandmother had me down at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church. I played for every thing that could happen down there. Children, I was pretty young. The missionaries had me going down to with them to various feeding places that are still in existence now. So I know every hymn because I had to play the missionary hymns. I just got indoctrinated solely into music for lack of being able to do anything in the neighborhood. My grandmother was kind of like a little strict, and at that time the Black Panthers were pretty predominant down in West Oakland, and a lot of things were going on that I didn't understand. And they were from the old school. They didn't talk about it very much. Like Belva Davis was saying, they never mentioned they went through a depression. My great-grandmother and her husband came out again with the Southern Pacific Movement.
Oh, okay. From Louisiana, too, or from where?
From Texas.
Texas, okay.
Yeah, and I didn't know, because my great-grandfather had passed before I was born, that he probably was one of the people working on the railroads.
Oh.
My great-grandmother was a dietary cook for Kaiser Hospital when they used to have still cooking there. And she worked there 25 years without a day of taking sick leave. She got an honor when she got retired from there. And so they didn't talk much about slavery and depression. And we knew the Black Panthers were there because I had breakfast. They fed us every morning. But I didn't know much about why or what the struggle was about, because we lived in a black community that even though the projects were across the street, everybody seemed happy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being delusional, but everybody seemed like they were just happy. So out of that experience, I just, the Hawkins were, my dad actually played for them at one time when they, before they recorded Oh Happy Day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a lot of influences from the Hawkins, and because I was in the Adventist school, they specialize in having music all the time. So I got exposed to a lot of conventional music and sacred music. And but by the same token, I was still involved in churches, our local black churches, doing gospel or trying to learn gospel at the time. And it just took on, I have my mind is operating with gospel and classical music together. So, Richard, when Richard Smallwood came out, it was like, oh, there's somebody I play like, you know. So that's part of it. And the other part is because my my dad, of course, being a jazz musician, had to deal with a lot of the struggles that a lot of the musicians of that day and time had with drug addiction and alcohol. So went through a lot of issues, and out of that birthed a lot of songs.
Mm-hmm.
Just a lot of songs.
Yeah.
About emotional experiences, good and bad. But
mm-hmm.
mainly that, because I was in church so much, it was like there's always such a positive aura about being in church or being around people, even, you know, just... I've always just been surrounded by great people, people that have enormous positivity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I try to write about.
Right, yeah. Well, I just want to let my other guests know that I know you're in the studio. We're wrapping this up, but I'm running a little bit late. So stay there.
No problem.
With regards to this Healing Body and Soul, the second annual benefit concert, maybe you could talk a little bit about sort of the healing aspects of art, because it sounds as if, you know, you found some solace in your music, in having this ability to be able to translate what you were feeling into a tangible, you know, product that others could share in with you and be, you know, maybe they might not know the story, but they could feel the emotion. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I found that over the period of time, a lot of people are, you know, if you talk to them, they are sometimes they're turned off by what you may have to offer or say. But for some reason, when things come over and there's music behind it, sometimes the depending on the delivery of the sounds of music, it opens up an avenue to me in your brain or in your spirit where it kind of massages your way in. So the same message, I could say, you can make a difference. And you go, yeah, sure. When you hear it in the music, it kind of like weaves its way around some parts of your inner spirit. And many times things are said and sung in such a manner where there was hurt, there was a lot of issues going on, and the music can kind of just soothe. I'm certain there's some, you know, dissertations written on that type of thing, but when you see a variety of people coming from all walks of life, all places, all faiths, all religions, all together, and the message is coming forward, the same message, we love, we're promoting love, we're promoting healing. And no matter how it's voiced or how it's said verbally, everyone is there together. It's like a whole synergy going on of love, 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 peace, joy. And these kind of programs, people pick up on that. So I think it just offers that type of spirit where the pieces of us that are hurting or reaching out, saying, oh, yes, I need this. It's kind of massaging it in the background. We don't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just by the whole synergy of all the mixes of people just offering sounds and voices and spoken word of love through what they're just by the fact they're all there together sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I know last year it was just amazing. The number of people that came out, and a lot of people attended in support of their youth or their children, but they really said after the program they really just really enjoyed it, and it was just uplifting. And I think today we need things that are just uplifting. There's so much bad stuff going on that this is really a way that you can feel motivated to go on forward and to keep, you know, pressing on and sharing that same, wanting to share that same type of feeling.
Right, yeah. Well, it definitely, you have a stellar lineup of ensembles. My goodness, I mean, each one.
And it's free, and it's free. It's a free concert. It's free.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, this is a free concert, and, you know, any one of these ensembles could just be the featured ensemble for the whole afternoon. But they're gonna be sharing the program, you know, with each other, and so it's going to really be wonderful. Did you raise a lot of money last year to send to these various relief humanitarian organization efforts you support?
You know what, I'm going to be honest with you, that part of it, because I'm a musician,
mm-hmm.
I never did ask.
Okay.
I'm certain there was a targeted amount, and I know we raised the goal. I think it was, the total was near $15,000, and I think they raised it last year.
Well, that's excellent.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Terry, for joining us to talk about the second annual Healing Body and Soul Benefit Concert at St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church, 2024 Ashby Avenue in Berkeley. They have a wonderful website, St. Paul Berkeley, stpaulberkeley.com. And the address again is 2024 Ashby Avenue, and the phone number there is 510-848-2050. And you can call for more information, and or you could just show up.
Yes. Thank you, Wanda, for having me. This is great.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm trying to get your song, His Eye Is on the Sparrow, with It Is Well With My Soul. And so that's what I'm going to play at the end of the show. You will no longer be with us, but I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, thank you.
Is there anything you want to tell us about that particular piece?
No, I have a CD of just original arrangements of my favorite hymns. And those songs are almost like universal, almost like We Are the World type of songs. His Eye Is on the Sparrow, because we know we believe in a power that just loves us and is so concerned about us that even our littlest thing that goes on with us, he knows about or she knows about. And it's just, those are songs that touched me as I was growing up and still are very important to me in my life.
Well, thank you so much again, and I don't know how I'm going to do all the things that I need to do on Sunday, because they're in different cities and all at the same time. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, how am I going to do that?
Well, we're going to record this, and so if we get a copy of the recording, I will make sure you get one.
Okay, well, I definitely want to, like, put my face in, like, at least peek in. So I'm going to try to figure this out.
Okay.
Yeah, what's your dad's name, by the way?
Clifford Washington.
Clifford Washington. Okay. All right, cool. Is he still with us?
Yes.
Oh, so he'll probably be at John Handy's 80th birthday party.
Well, I'm going to let him know about it. He just can't play anymore. He's kind of lost his armature, his teeth. So, but I will let him know. He's a good friend of him, yes.
Okay. All right, you take good care.
Thank you. Thank you, Wanda.
Right. Sure, you're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Okay.
So we are joined by some of the choreographers for Black Choreographers Here and Now. This is week 3, and I don't know if people have been, like, going to all of the events every week, but it's just been simply fantastic. So I don't know who's in the studio, but I was expecting Serenity. Serenity, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, super. And then Athea, beautiful one, Thompson, and her daughter, Nafi Watson Thomas. Are you both with us?
Yes, we are.
Okay, cool. You all must be doing a, sharing a, the phone, huh?
Yes.
Okay, cool, super. And I don't know, Robert Henry Johnson is not with us, but maybe he might join us before the program ends. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read your bios, and then maybe like Serenity, I'll start with you, and then you could tell us a little bit about, you know, what you have created for this weekend for Black Choreographers Here and Now, ninth year of programming, which is so exciting, and it's all going to be happening at Dance Mission Theater in San Francisco at 24th and Mission, right across the street from the 24th Street Bar Station. And it's, let's see, 8 o'clock tonight, Friday, 8 o'clock Saturday night, and 7 o'clock on Sunday night, the 24th. And I don't know, you might want to start tonight, Friday, and go back. Are you all going to be talking about your work on Sunday night? Is there a panel after that?
I do believe there is a panel. I think on Sunday there will be a panel.
Okay, yeah, so that's the 7 o'clock performance. The panels are so wonderful because then you get a chance to talk to the choreographers after the program and ask them about their work. So, Serenity, you write that by trade you are a dancer, choreographer, director, and teacher. In a world of increasing disparity, you said, you find and create beauty that kindles your heart. And in 2002, while attending San Francisco State University, you established a dance company, Seidako? Is that how you pronounce it? Okay. It's a theater, a dance theater company, and you've been creating ever since. So that's, that's about 11 years now. Your work has been seen at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Oh, my gosh, you must be hecka good. ODC, San Francisco Pilot Series. I love their pilot series. It's wonderful.
Yes.
And other performance venues in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I don't know you, and I'm like, oh, I'm so happy that the Black Choreographers has brought you there because you're famous, and you've been doing this for 11 years, and I've never seen your work.
I don't know about famous, but...
Well, no, you are famous. 11 years, you've been to D.C., and you've been performing around town, and I don't know you, so it's like, so I'm glad I'm going to get a chance to see your work this weekend. You just recently received a Master's in Business Administration from Loki?
Yeah, Loki.
Loki Graduate School of Business at Mills College in Oakland, California. Oh, my goodness, you're a Mills woman. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Yay is right. By studying at Mills, you have the opportunity to work with Grameen Trust. Oh, I know Grameen Bank. I teach it. Nafi, you know Grameen Bank, right?
Yeah,
Muhammad Yunus. And you're able to study the Grameen model of microfinance and also led the Net Impact chapter at Mills College for 2 years. You must know my friend Eloise Burrell.
Eloise,
yeah, Eloise is working on her master's now in, I think, is it business as well?
Yes, I think so. We've taken class together a few times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a wonderful singer. Serenity is currently serving as Director of Programs at Chinda Foundation, where the organization supports and empowers communities in Arusha, Tanzania. Oh, my goodness,
yes.
I'm going there this summer. Oh, this is
Everybody's
having all these connections. Yeah, I'm going to go hang out with Mama Charlotte and Brother Pete.
Wow, I have family in Tanzania, so I was there last year for 2 months. So.
Oh, really?
Yes, you're going to love it.
We have to, I know I am, we have to connect.
Yes, absolutely, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, just I'm reading your bio and like, and stopping with all this conversation. But anyway, throughout all of your experiences, Serenity draws inspiration from the local startup community and is currently working on her own ideas, which incorporate her thirst to make an impact. And so you do all this economic development work, and then you're a choreographer. Wow. So tell me about what you have for this year's program, and are you dancing or choreographing for your company?
So I'm choreographing for my company,
mm-hmm.
and the work that I've created this year is an inspiration from another choreographer by the name of Elio Pomari, who passed away about 2008 or 2009. He's this New York choreographer who came up during the times of Alvin Ailey and some of the big New York names in the 50s and 60s. He was from the West Indies, and he came over to the United States and he had his own dance company, and he was very different from what everyone else was doing at the time. And so while I was studying at San Francisco State, one of my classes, we were studying Black dance in America, and his profile came up. We watched a few of his pieces, and this particular piece that we were watching was called The Junkie, and it just stood out to me. It just hit me, and ever since then, I couldn't stop thinking about that particular solo that he created on this Black gentleman. And ever since then, it always just stuck to me. There's something about that piece that I saw that I really wanted to go back to see if I can do something with it, or I wanted to see it again. I couldn't get rid of the idea. And some of the messages that was coming out from Pomari's piece. And so this opportunity came up with Black choreographers, and I just said, hey, I just need to kind of get this out of my body, out of my mind, and create something inspired from Elio Pomari's solo work of The Junkie. And so that's what we'll be presenting this weekend, is kind of that, and it comes from that inspiration. And what it is it's a solo dancer, Robert Henry Johnson, who's my dancer, and it just shows characteristics and personalities and situations of Black men, particularly in America. And Pomari's piece touched on, it was about a junkie. It was about, and you know, in New York around 1965 when this was created, it was heroin and what was going around. And so his dancer on stage was, you know, shooting up, and he was trying to sell to the audience. And so this piece with Robert Henry Johnson is kind of a break from that, but it still has the same notes and same ideas in it. It's not only about a junkie, but it's about different characters, different men, and how people or America or society sees Black men. So he portrays several characters throughout the whole piece. And it's really great. It's fun and it's touching. It's a bit shocking, and we really want people to come out and see it and talk about it and talk about what they might see and mm-hmm. what they feel about it. So I'm really excited, and so is Robert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Robert Henry Johnson is a wonderful artist, dancer, writer, choreographer. I just, when you were talking about The Junkie, I was thinking about you know, addiction, and I was wondering, and self-medication, and living in a society where, you know, there is structural racism, and so how does one
right.
manage that? You know, do we self-medicate? You know, how do we
right.
do we change ourselves to try to fit in, you know, to this
dominant
discourse? And I was wondering, was your The Junkie, is it like a metaphor as well, and or is the original a metaphor as well as the actual, you know, drug addiction?
I think ours would be, you actually touched on everything that we try to address and bring up.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the self-medicating, it's about trying to fit into society, it's about recognizing that that people are, you know, either pigeonholing you in a certain area, or you can't get away from your own personal addiction. We try to cover the entire gamut of a person who's a corporate American, you know, got a Black male, has got his top job, he's making it in his career, he's driving the BMW, he's wearing a nice suit, but he's self-medicating. You know, we don't see that, but, you know, you can still see that within his eyes. And we see, you know, everything from the hip-hop street guy, pants down to his ankles, talking to people, and just want to get a quarter, just want to get this. He's just the person who's just trying to suck in and get something from you no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And we touched on all those ideas. And junkie can be anyone. They look like everything, every walk of life, from the CEO all the way down to, you know, the homeless person on the street. You just never know these days. And back then, Elio Palmari's work was about a junkie, a drug dealer. Mm-hmm. You know, the glasses, smoking a cigarette, trying to get another hit, trying to get make another dollar, trying to sell you something, a watch, you know, just so he can get his hit. And so my piece is, it's a little bit about that, but a lot more. And, and you know, just touch on different subjects, like you talked about, self-medication. And we did a lot of research about that, about trauma. Trauma is another thing that we were talking about, Robert and I, and how people are not talking about things that they're experiencing, and they keep it to themselves, and therefore they self-medicate. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, things start to fall apart from their relationships, particularly Black men and relationships to women and relationships to society and to each other, how they talk to each other, how other people see them. And so we wanted to narrow it down, but we realized that, you know, we'd rather have it an open conversation and talk about all these things that do pop up in the piece.
Right, yeah. Yeah, how do you spell the choreographer's name that from West Indies that inspired this piece?
Oh, Elio, E-L-E-O, Pomari, P-O-M-A-R-E.
Okay, all right, super. And another couple of other things I was thinking when you were speaking was how difficult it is to maintain one's sobriety. And that we live among leeches, you know, stealing our ideas, you know, and taking credit for it, you know, sort of keeping us marginalized as a community. I'm talking Black people in particular. You know, we're so creative, but we can't get in. You know, it's like, oh, I'll take your idea, but you can't come. And then so the isolation that a lot of people feel, you know, in this, you know, increasingly global high-tech society that we live in, where, you know, people don't physically connect, and then they wear things like headphones and other kind of things to say, I don't want you to talk to me either.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is really interesting that you brought that up. Yes, we live in a world where, you know, we're plugging or we're covering our ears with headphones or blasting our music. We're busy with our smartphones. We're Facebooking and IMing and Twittering, and but we can't, for some reason, look at one another. You know, I was just thinking about it this morning. I'm standing on the bus, and, you know, no one wants to look at one another. You can't look each other in the eye. If you do, you get caught, and you just kind of look away real quickly, as if it's something bad or terrible. And you know, in different countries, it's different. You can look at one another, and people talk to you, and that's another, you know, subject that we do try to approach and make happen. That this character that Robert plays in my piece, he's in everyone's face. He wants people to look at him. And Robert, who wrote the text for the piece, his characters, you know, say this. You know, he's a homeless guy on the street, and all he wants people to do is just look at him, just look at me, you know, he's a human being too, he deserves to be looked at, to be just respected and acknowledged that he is here and that, you know, we're here today and that's all that he's asking for. It's a very simple thing, and you'd be surprised, you know, that people just want to be acknowledged, people just want to be, you know, just to be, want people to, you know that they're alive,
mm-hmm.
and that they're
right.
here,
mm-hmm.
and that they want validation for it, and that's
exactly.
what it is.
Yeah, and I always try to make sure that even if I'm not giving someone spare change, I look at them, because that eye contact means that I acknowledge that you're here, you're present, you're human, you're the same as me. And when, because more often than not, a lot of people don't look at certain people. And that
exactly.
means that they're invisible. But they really aren't invisible, but they're invisible. And they feel
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've done it many times. I'm guilty. I've done it, you know. When a group of men are approaching me on the opposite side of the street, I look at them, and maybe about we're coming 10 feet towards each other, I look down, mm-hmm. you know. or I see someone who is just talking mad and asking people for change and trying to get something, and, you know, I'll see them, but then I'll look down and I'll keep walking and I'll just mumble something to him. Mm-hmm. But I've tried, you know, every day I try to do it differently and acknowledge him and say, hey, I'm sorry, I don't have anything for you today, but I hope you have a great day. And, you know, they say, thank you for looking at me, thank you, and I hope you have a good day. And it's like, you know, I don't have anything for you, but I do acknowledge you that you're here. Everyone wants validation, and everyone, you know, announces that in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so this piece really hits on that, touches on that, and particularly for Black men, mm-hmm. and the different perceptions that people have of Black men and how they see themselves and how other people see them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, thank you, Serenity. Afia and Nafi, is so wonderful that the two of you founded Bahia Movement in 2011. So your company years old. And as directors, the dynamic mother and daughter duo fuse hip-hop, jazz, modern, and African dance to create an electrifying, energetic movement that stands above the rest. Afia received her acclaim 20 years ago in West African dance and has since performed nationally and internationally in other genres such as jazz, hip-hop, lindy hop, freestyle, and modern dance. Wow, Nafi must have been dancing inside of you, huh?
Yes, she was.
Yeah, Afia says that she is constantly refining her skills and versatility as a performer through yearly conferences, workshops, and performances, and she's taught classes in the Oakland community for 15-plus years to professional dancers and dance enthusiasts ranging in age from 5 to 65 years old. You need to, like, be pushed that to, like, 90 because, you know, people are living long nowadays. And I have a friend, Sister McKenya, who is... God, Sister McKenna still in her 80s? She might still be in her 80s, and she dances.
Wow, yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. You know, it keeps you moving. It keeps you energetic. It keeps you happy inside and out. Dance is a release. Dance helps you to release different things that you may have going on in your body and your life. It's a stress reliever. Mm-hmm. So, definitely. And it keeps you young.
Yeah, because when Nafi introduced me to you last year, I'm like, whoa, that's her mother? And I didn't even know that you were a dancer choreographer until right now. Well, not right now, but last week when Laurie Lane told me that Nafi, I knew Nafi was programming. You know, she had a piece in the next wave, but I didn't know that you were her mother, and that she was dancing in your work, too. And I just found out just now, reading the bio, that you all have a company. I mean, like,
yeah.
It's real. You're really understating your work, Nafi. I remember seeing her in Baba Zach's classes, and I would, like, just love to watch them, like, when the professional folks walk across the floor, right? Just like, ooh, I want to dance like that one day.
Yeah, and I think we've all been there, and I'm still there. You know, I still have people that, like Laura Ellis, that I look up to, that I want to strive to be like Deborah Vaughn, you know, like Papa Zach and Naomi, who are my teachers, you know. So, I mean, I look at them, and that's where I set my goal and my you know, my challenges and my accomplishments towards what they've already accomplished. I want to walk in their footsteps, and I want to be like them so then I can leave my footsteps for someone else so I can pay it forward to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think we always strive and always have someone to look up to so we know that there is possibilities, that we, you know, we have the possibility to hit the stars and go beyond. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Right, yeah. And you write that, you know, in the your vision for Bahia Movement is to cross and break all barrier lines regarding body image and self-image through the art of dance. And your goal is to show the world, you and your daughter's goal through this company, is to show the world that it's not about your body size or type that defines you as a dancer, but rather the skill, technical training, creativity, and love of the art that does. And I was thinking just now reading that about Garth Fagan's dance company, and that's what I really loved about his company is that you see all of us you know, in his company. And that's one thing that's wonderful about African dance. It's like you see all of us, the whole community is there, you know, big, small, short, tall, whereas certain forms, you know, certain European forms, you don't see all of us as a community of people. You only see certain people, and they all, you know, the body types are pretty uniform.
Yes. And that's one of the things that I definitely, when I, as I grew up, because I've always wanted to be a dancer, and I used to actually tell my mother and Mama Naomi, you know, I want to be a professional dancer. And what I got, the feedback that I got was, you don't have the body type to be a professional dancer. You don't have a body type to do the jazz dance that is out there and for you to, you know, make a career out of it. And so that stuck with me, and it kind of made me think, I mean, how unfair is that? You know, I didn't choose this body. This is what I was given. So now I'm you know, X'd out of being something or trying to strive towards something that I love to do because of my body type. That's not right.
No, it isn't.
So that's the reason why I said, you know, if I ever get a chance to do something for the community and for, you know, the world, that's what I want to do. I want to show that, hey, I love dance, and I'm going to go for it. I'm going to dance my heart out, regardless of how big, regardless of how small, regardless of what my technical skills are. I'm going to go ahead and do it. I'm going to follow my dream. I'm going to follow my heart, because I never know what may happen, what opportunities may open up for me. But if I never try, if I just get shot down because someone else is telling me I can't do it, then I will never know. I will never know.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us about this piece that you have choreographed for this weekend, and then Nafi, I'll introduce you, and you can talk about your work that you have choreographed as well. But let's talk about first about this one that you are dancing in that your mother choreographed. Why don't you tell us about it?
My piece is about molestation. It's about being violated. And I think that a lot of people haven't really decided to touch on this topic. This is a topic that is happening all around the world, and we just don't address it. We sweep it under the rug. And for myself, I've been molested, and I'm tired of carrying that around with me. I know that I need to address it so I can move forward. And I want to be able to use myself as a platform to let people know that it's okay to talk about it. It's okay to confront the issues that's going on if you're ready to confront them, if you're ready to address it, if you're ready to say enough is enough. So you can close that chapter of your life and feel better and feel good about yourself and know that it's not your fault and move forward.
Interesting. I went to a book signing last night at Modern Times Book in San Francisco with the author Ayabo Williams, who wrote a book called Hidden Scars, and she is writing about being molested, but actually raped, because she came up in the war in Nigeria and was raped by one of the soldiers, and then that just continued sort of a cycle of sexual abuse. And she's here in the United States now, and actually spent like 14 years, I believe, in prison because of her response to saying no to the continued abuse. And she was saying how once, you know, one has been violated as she has been, and as you mentioned, you have been, it never goes away. You can sort of you know, heal, but it stays with you in the ways that other types of pain and hurt and injuries do, you know, eventually sort of you can actually move away from and move on. Tell us about the piece, and do you agree with what she says about this type of violation and this type of abuse or this type of injury?
I do agree. And I think what I mean about being able to heal from it or to say enough is enough is we hold, sometimes we just hold on to it and we don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It will never go away. You are always going to, I have relationship problems because of what has happened. And that is going to be with me for the rest of my life. And so, but now I feel better about how to deal with my relationships now because I'm finally addressing what has happened to me when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to live with this horrible pain of being violated for the rest of my life. But now I can mentally say, but it's okay, Afia. You can move on. It was not your fault. You know what I mean? It's like I can think about it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it differently. I you know, I accept it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I do agree with her. I just think that we have to, I think that we should talk about it because talking is therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you to feel like, it's not all my fault. I am okay. I have others that have been in this situation. I'm not by myself. I'm not alone,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it just helps to bring that community of togetherness, of, you know, feeling like I have support.
Yeah, but you're not talking. You choreograph some work. So you're not talking. You're talking through movement. So is Nafi, is this a solo performance or is there a company? How do you translate this story into movement?
It's a collaborative of five. It's five of us that's working it out. And in the piece, it's segments in the piece. So I revisit the violation. So you would go through that experience with me. Then I go through a feeling of why me? Why did this happen? Why do I deserve this? Can you help me? A period of asking for assistance and asking for help.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see where I get the help. You see where I get support. And so I show you that. I show you that this is a way in how you can release this. And then you go, then I go into the next segment of, okay, now that, you know, you asked for this help, we are showing you how to help you and get through this pain. Now it's on you. Now you have to continue on helping yourself. So it's four segments of the piece. It's a 20-minute piece,
okay.
and it goes through the whole experience of one that made that, you know, of the experience of being violated, and then go through asking for assistance, getting the assistance, and then what do I do after I get the assistance? How do I continue to help myself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Nafi, is this a story that you were familiar with, or was this a new aspect of this woman you call mother? and how is it for you dancing in the piece? Talk about that.
She never really told me until I got older. We had went to this church, and she had spoke about it. So when hearing the story, it really shocked me, especially after I heard who did it, to really put a different feel on it. I've read different books in class about it and hearing about getting raped and seeing it on different TV shows, but when it had happened to my mom, it just made me feel different, and to see her go through it and to hear her cry, it really hurts to continue dancing, but you know, I have to be strong for her and myself. But it was hard. It was something that I just couldn't believe that had happened, and I wish I can go back in time and stop it, but you know, I can't. But yeah, so it was hard, but now it's just something that we have to deal with, and I'm just trying to help her kind of get over it.
So do you have a particular, like there are five people dancing. Do you all have different parts? Is it like a theater dance piece?
It's very much so theatrical. They have to act. They have to stay in character. So, yes, I'm telling the story. I'm telling the story, a serious story through my piece. I'm telling the story. It's a little out there. It's a little out there. So I would advise if people are bringing kids to think twice about it, because I don't hold back. I do not hold back. I leave it on theater. I leave it on the dance floor. I leave it on the stage. I really tell the story from beginning to end of what happened to me.
Okay.
So they do go into character. From beginning to end, there is different characters that they have to take on to help tell the story.
So is this a world premiere, or have you danced before?
It's a world premiere. This is my first showing. Yes.
Wow. Excellent. Wonderful. So Nafi, I've had the pleasure of being your professor at the College of Alameda. I've had the pleasure of seeing your work last semester as a part of the choreography showcase at Laney College, and you choreographed a piece in that particular program as well as danced, and it was phenomenal. What was the name of the piece that you choreographed?
Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, it was really, really wonderful. And you began dancing at the tender age of 3, you know, once you left your mother, because you were dancing in there too. you were dancing with Spelman's College's youth dance program in Atlanta, Georgia. So how'd you get there?
Well, I was born here, and then we have moved out there, and my mom was going to Spelman for a little bit, so that's how I was able to get into the dance program. And then my mom came back to Oakland to finish college, and I stayed with my grandparents in Georgia. Oh. And I think I came back out here around the 5th grade, and I've been in Oakland since. So I kind of moved around, but from the 5th grade on, I've been in Oakland.
Wow, so you got some Southern sensibilities in your DNA and in your rearing and in your socialization. And does that come out in your choreography? Sort of being having that Southern root, those Southern roots, so to speak?
No.
No? Doesn't come out? No, not at all. Okay. So you are a well-rounded performer, choreographer, and study West African dance with Diamanta Kora, West African Dance Company, which is where I saw you for the first time. And as I said, I just love watching you move. And hip-hop, modern, and jazz, and ballet with Dimensions Dance Theater's Rites of Passage program. You work with talented professionals such as Don James, LaTanya Tigner, Corey Action, Tracy Bartlow, Carla Service, and many more fabulous choreographers. You train with Dimensions Extensions Performing Ensemble under the direction of LaTanya Tigner again, who focused on strengthening Nafi's technique while developing her to become an accomplished performer. Your time at Skyline High School with Don James enhanced your skills as a dancer and helped transform you into a young woman. Your desire to explore different types of dances make you appreciate dance and widen your dance vocabulary. Your focus is to continue learning and perfecting your skills towards becoming an extraordinary dancer. So I presume that this is a career goal as well?
Yeah, but I kind of want to be behind the scenes more. Like, I still want to perform, but I want to really actually put my work out there and just choreograph more.
Mm-hmm.
But taking dance, I do, but I want to come like a physical therapist, a dance therapist, so I can learn how to heal injuries. So I kind of want to be more behind the scenes of dance, I guess.
Uh-huh. But yeah. Okay, yeah. And you say that your number one focus as a dancer is to connect and stay in tune with the body, and dancing is definitely a big part of your life, and you love dance, and dancing has helped mold you into the young woman you are today. So talk about what you have choreographed for this next wave, which is being performed, I believe, is it Sunday, Saturday, and Sunday? Because it's not being performed tonight.
No, it's just Sunday.
Just Sunday. Okay, yeah. So people have to, you have to go twice if you get up, because Navi is dancing every evening, but her piece is going to be performed on Sunday. So tell us about the work. What's the name of it? And are you dancing or are you behind the scenes that you mentioned?
I was trying to be behind the scenes, but I end up dancing. So it's called Impulse. The dance is called Impulse, and it's about basically five girls that end up in a, I want to say like an insane asylum or a halfway house, not a halfway house, a crazy house, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically about how different teens go through life and ending up being depressed or suicidal. I read a book called Impulse by Ellen Hopkins, and it was basically about the same thing. They ended up in the house like that, and they had to help each other get over what they are suffering from. So one person was addicted to pills, the other one was trigger happy, so they almost shot themselves, and then the other person was a cutter. So I have those different characters in that. So by reading that book and seeing different movies, I wanted to kind of bring that book to life and make a dance out of it. In high school, like around senior year, I did get depressed, so I can really relate to that book, and reading that book and going to therapy really helped me kind of realize that my life is way too important to take it or to leave this. I'm here for a reason. So that's what I wanted to dance about, and I came up with the dance.
Yeah, is that the book that that you wrote your paper on, that you told us about in your presentation?
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. the same one.
Uh-huh, yeah. Wow, so did you let the author know that you have translated her book into a dance?
No, I should do that.
You definitely should do that. Yeah, I would be so excited if I was an author and knew that I inspired someone to create a dance, based on characters and themes from my book.
Yeah,
you really like this author. You've read lots of her work.
Yeah, it really spoke to me in high school, so I continue reading. I have almost all her books at home, so
mm-hmm.
they're really good.
Yeah. So, Nafi, you write that that dance helped mold you into the young woman that you are today. Just talk about just sort of having this creative outlet and how that helped move you through some difficult times in your young life. Like, what if you wouldn't have had this outlet? I mean, your mother's a dancer and choreographer, so you've had this. You were dancing when you were with your grandparents who raised you until you came to California to be with your mother again. So talk about sort of having that creative outlet and how that saved you, so to speak.
It was helpful because I know a lot of people, some of their outlets is be running or playing sports or writing, and since my passion is dance, it was just something that I can connect to very well, and just being able to go and take a dance class when I'm stressed out or just talking about it or watching different dance shows really just opened my eyes to continue or pursue this passion of mine. And so how it helped me just being able to connect with different dancers and traveling and seeing different people and just really seeing the theatric part of it and seeing that you can tell a story through dance and write a whole essay just based, you know, just dancing. And it's to me that really caught my attention, being able to, this art that you can just move and tell different stories, that really helps. So going out and seeing different performances and talking to different people about different issues that I went through and dancing about it, that's how it helped me kind of just mold to where I am now. And I'm still growing. I'm only 19, and I'm like, and the artistic director of my own company with my mom. So it's like I have this title, and I'm still kind of like, what do I do? How do I go from here? Because my mom is the business part about it, and I'm just the dance part, but I have to start learning the business part, and I'm just like, I just want to dance. I don't want to do calling people and getting shows. I believe that to my mom, but I don't know, but it's a learning experience, and I'm really excited that I started it now because I know that I can take it further.
Right, yeah, interesting. I was just thinking about, you know, the large motor skills involved in dance and the big gestures. You know, we can have these ideas in our head, but dance is something that you can't hide it. It's a physical dimension, and that, you know, you're sharing these ideas, and a lot of times, you know, from what, you know, this particular weekend, you know, the Bahia movement with your mother's piece, you know, is a really personal piece. I mean, you know, people might not know that it's, this is something that really happened, unless you tell them. But it's like they still will be connected. Similarly with Serenity's piece, you know, emotionally to these characters on stage talking about these really devastating moments in their lives, which are not moments that are isolated to their particular lives. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Bahia movement specifically. When I say the name, I think about Brazil, and I think about Salvador, and I think about, you know, the large African population in, you know, on that particular continent, in that particular region. And so I was wondering about, you know, if you could talk about that place, and if the name is resonating with the history and the geography that I just mentioned.
No, actually, Bahia with the Y, B-A-H-I-Y-A,
mm-hmm.
it's a Swahili name, and it's and it means beautiful.
Oh.
And so my stage name is Beautiful One,
mm-hmm.
the company is Beautiful, and movement. So I think that that's what we do as dancers. We create beautiful movements.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to continue that resonating beautifulness that goes through from beginning to end. You have a thought, then you make that thought come into reality, and then you be able to express that and share that reality with others, and then maybe it triggers like a domino effect. So it contains that beautiful love and movement that would go from, it's like a contagious disease, but it's a beautiful life and movement. So when I saw the word, I didn't think about Bahia,
mm-hmm.
you know, until I started saying, oh, my goodness, oh, yeah, I forgot Bahia. So, I love it because I don't really dance Brazilian dance, but I'm starting to take more classes, and I'm starting to get more involved in it because now my company is Bahia, and I know people are going to ask,
mm-hmm.
is that where you got that from? Are you connecting that to that? And it's not. It's actually something totally different.
Mm-hmm.
It is a Swahili name, and it means beautiful.
Yeah,
so,
interesting. But, you know, that might have been, you know, the overt or the intention behind the name. But then you have these other resonance, because I think about, you know, when you write poetry and you might have a particular idea for a particular reading of the work, and then someone else will read it and they'll have another reading. It's like, oh, and that's there, but you didn't know it was there because that wasn't your intention. So it's like, like, you know, it's like poetry, you know. So I take it. It's like, okay, well, that wasn't my original intention, but hey, I take that too.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. And then I was thinking about Serenity, and the language that's spoken in Tanzania and Kenya is Kiswahili, which is kind of cool.
Yes.
Yeah, so I was wondering if we can close this wonderful conversation with, you know, all of us talking maybe about beauty, because within this pain, because even Nafi's piece, you know, it sort of speaks to some places that are dark and uncomfortable and painful, yet the characters are able to transcend that. I don't know about the junkie, but maybe you know, someone's going to recognize him and help him sort of step into his greatness and leave behind, you know, the addiction, and be able to be strong enough to face, you know, the reality without, you know, the medication, which is clouding things up. And then when you become sober, it's still there. Yeah. So as long as you could talk about beauty.
I'm sorry. Before you say that, this is Afia.
Yes.
You said maybe not the junkie, but let's look at Malcolm X. You know, Malcolm X was a junkie.
Yeah.
And what did he do? He turned his life around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are junkies out there that are now doing a beautiful thing with their life. So it is, you know, we do have that ability and that power to change our life, to change our ending, to rewrite the story.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, may have started off rocky and a little shaky and end with something beautiful and powerful.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, because yesterday was the 48th anniversary of his being killed. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought his name, as we could say Ashe to his name, you know, pour some libations. But, yeah, that's, I totally agree. Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with you. So, Serenity, since you've been listening, why don't we start with you to talk about beauty.
Beauty. Well, with my piece, it's called Psalm Number 5. The beauty is in the story. This is just the story of many characters of black men, of men, and perceptions and their how people perceive them in society, how they feel about themselves. It's just a glimpse. It's just a snippet of each different person. And the beauty is, I think, is when you walk away, when you're done that night after seeing all the performances and reflecting on what you've just saw and seeing if any of it resonates within you, and if any of those people, those characters that you've seen, are they a part of you? Do you see yourself up there? Have you lived any of their lives? And how can you change it for somebody else to make it better, just a little bit better, even if it's just validating them by acknowledging them, looking them in the eye, and just saying hello when they're asking for something that you cannot provide for them. But being human and just looking them and say, hey, I acknowledge you. And I think there's something beautiful about that. That's something that's missing today in our world with all this technology. It's just coming back to saying hello and acknowledging one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the human spirit is definitely beautiful, definitely. Yeah, thank you. Nafi?
It was a dance that we did at Lane from Jackie Burgess, and it was about dogs and how they were evil. No, they started off nice and then it turned off evil, and she at the end we had to say beauty is only skin deep. And I think that's true, because if you kind of go out and just look at different people. Some people might have, oh, that person is ugly, but inside they're really beautiful. And to me, I think that if you're ugly inside, that's what makes you ugly on the outside. But if you're, you know, good and beautiful, then that can show inside and out. So even going through being a junkie or just depression and cutting yourself and being addicted, you can just find that outlet or something that will help you find that beauty inside of you, and that would come and show out on the outside.
Afia?
I think I want to ditto the both of them, Serenity as well as mine. because, I mean, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but you do have to make beauty what it is for you. Someone in the audience may look at all three of our pieces and say, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. How dare them? It may be upset. It may say, you know, that's ugly. That's terrible. How dare them? And then someone else may receive it, like you said earlier, and say, I'm so thankful that someone finally spoke out about it, because that's how I've been feeling and it's helping me. Mm-hmm. So it's what you take from it. It's what you take, you know, from your life. It's what you decide to make your life to be. Do you want your life to be beautiful where you can then resonate and be a beacon for someone else? Or do you want it to be where you're selfish? Or you don't care, or you know, so it's really up to that person. It's up to the individual. And so, you know, we can find beauty in everything.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to decide that's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, as choreographers, dancers, as you know, art makers. You know, this thing that we do as human beings, you know, this creative process we call art, is something that is unique to the human species. I mean, we actually intentionally go out and do this. and this art-making process is a way that I think that has maybe held us well insofar as the longevity that our species has been here on the planet. And hopefully what will keep us here on the planet, you know, being able to make this art, being able to use art to figure things out. Because, you know, we use art to figure out things that are, you know, pretty devastating and ugly, but the art process is beauty within itself.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, so thank you all so much for, you know, for continuing this process and for, you know, allowing us, you know, to be in the room and witness and participate in the performance. Because it sounds like these performances, these choreographed pieces are really interactive. It sounds like we are not going to be just passively watching. It sounds like you're going to be engaging us in a conversation and a dialogue.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We look forward to seeing you there and everyone else as well. We want a full house every night.
Yes. Right, yeah. So I want to thank Serenity, Afia, and Nafi for joining us today to talk about Black Choreographers Here and Now. Week 3, New Wave, and again, it's tonight, Friday night, February 22nd, 8 o'clock, Saturday, February 23rd, 8 o'clock, and Sunday, February 24th at 7 p.m., and the Sunday performance, which is the closing performance of this season of performances for Black Choreographers Here and Now, 9th anniversary year. There's going to be a panel discussion. You'll be able to meet these wonderful choreographers, and maybe some of the dancers might be sticking around, and you'll be able to, like, ask them those questions because you will have experienced the work. And so it won't be, you know, talking about it. It's like, oh, yeah, wow, how did you do that?
Yes, and also please...
Yes.
Check out the website as well.
Yes. You want to give it or you want me to tell it to them?
Oh, you can go ahead and tell it to them.
Okay. It's www.bcfhere.com. And all fees are $15. And again, programming contains adult subject matter, so parental discretion is advised. All righty. Well, good luck on tonight. I'm going to probably see you on Sunday evening because I can't figure out how to come twice, and I want to catch Nafi. So have a great opening weekend performance tonight, and I look forward to seeing you all on Sunday.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You take good care.
You too. All bye. Right,
many blessings. Bye-bye. So we are going to close with one of Terry's rearranged spirituals that she mentioned that she really loves. And this is His Eye is on the Sparrow with It Is Well with My Soul.